to the State of Games, a proud member of the Punch Board Media Content Network. I'm Dice Hate Me.
I'm Get Louder.
I'm Puppy Shogun.
And I'm Sedge Troll.
And we are a podcast all about anything and everything related to board and card games and more. So welcome to episode 150. Yes, 150. Or as Woo! Legitimately, not like that other Geek All-Stars podcast. But anyway, or as we like to call it, the one about going back to the well. So the topic of this podcast is going to be about reprints, title revitalizations, deluxified versions, and anniversary editions. Which ones seem to have been the most successful, and are they the best idea for an overinflated market? This topic, of course, also has a lot to do with our special guest, who everyone has no doubt noticed, Seth Jaffe, who is the longtime State of Games listener, co-designer of Olive Trains, designer of Eminent Domain, and head of development for Tasty Minstrel Games. So welcome to the podcast, Seth.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, if this runs long, Seth, this will work towards 4 hours of your community service. Thank you for being chained up with us.
You'll have to.
I assumed the Rambling Man song choice was based on the guest because I've been known to be verbose.
What? No. Why would that ever have been queued up for you? It was a twofer because I did it for you and to give Daryl a little bit more of a Southern rock, which I know he loves after last podcast. Anyway, we're glad you're here with us, Seth. Feel free to be as verbose as you want to be. This is the podcast, so go for it. Anyway, we'll get to the meat shortly, but we'll start with you, Seth, since you're the guest. What have you been playing or been up to lately?
Well, appropriate to today's topic, I'll just throw out Steamrollers, which I just got from Kickstarter in the mail. And so Steamrollers is a roll-and-write game that's sort of based on Age of Steam / Railroad Tycoon / Steam / Railways of the World or whatever incarnation it is now. It's a pretty good one, I think. I like the idea of roll and writes, but a lot of them are kind of light and not as interesting to me, I guess. But Steamrollers, so the way it works is you roll some dice and you take turns drafting them, and with each die you draft, you can do an action. And these actions are all based on like those train games where you can upgrade your engine so you can deliver farther. You can deliver a cube. There's a central board with some cubes on it and some cities. And like the blue cubes want to go to the blue cities. And you can deliver them as long as you have track connecting them on your own personal board, which you're drawing on, and a strong enough engine. So you can do that. You can another thing you can do is take these sort of like technology tiles or whatever from whoever has them or from the center. And some of them are one-time use things that you can use on a later turn, or some of them are constant abilities that you can steal from somebody else if they've been using it. One neat thing about this game is whenever you take them, you can't have it taken away from you until you've used it at least once. So that's nice. And all this stuff kind of reminds me of these games like Railways of the World, which I like a lot. I think I'd rather sit and play Railroad Tycoon for 2.5 hours than a quick 30-minute game of Steamrollers. But as roll and rights go, I do like this one, probably because it reminds me of those good games.
Hey, at least if you play it right, I'm sure it's probably a good game. But as you know, I played it wrong last time. So, hey, you know, it was pretty good, I guess. But I'm sure with the correct rules. You know.
I enjoyed it. I was not good at it at all. For whatever reason, it's interesting because it's so loose in its structure that it's freeform enough that you could actually dig yourself into a hole because you get too focused on routes and things. So what I did was I took too much time developing that long route to get the points instead of trying to get some intermediate deliveries going, and I just got smashed because by the time I got ready to deliver, the game was already over because I forgot that there's only three cities left or whatever that the game was over. By that point, I still had an ultra long route, and I could make a couple deliveries, but I was so far behind.
Yeah, one of the things I think that's really neat about the board games that isn't present in Steamrollers is needing to do shorter deliveries just to up your income and afford to do bigger deliveries. So that is missing from the roll and write, but then again, it's a 30-minute game. So I think it's a pretty good translation.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I'd like to try it again. I think it's a game that you would definitely get better at. And it's so fast you can play multiple iterations of it and get better at it.
And they do have a variety of those tiles you can get, so they're not necessarily the same every game. So maybe that'll help a little.
Yep, I agree. Anything else from you, or is that kind of what you've just been doing lately?
Besides that, I've mostly just been playtesting stuff. We just wrapped up. I've been doing development on a new game. That'll be kind of a sequel to a game that just came out from TMG called Pioneer Days. So this new one is by a different designer, but it's called Old West Empresario, and it's thematically a sequel in Pioneer Days. Has anyone played Pioneer Days yet, by the way?
I've not had a chance to. I want to, but I have not had a chance.
It's kind of like Oregon Trail in a board game. It's kind of it's pretty fun. It's a dice drafting game, and by Matt Dunstan and Chris Marling. And so at Gen Con, I saw this other dice drafting game that had the main dice drafting part was kind of similar, but the rest of it was different. It was city building and tile laying and stuff, and I liked it. And I've been working on it, and we're going to bring it out, and I'm going to have the art is going to match. It's going to be a sequel to Pioneer Days, because in Pioneer Days, you head out west with your wagon train, and in Old West Empresario, now you've gotten out to the west coast, you've been granted some land by the government, and now you're trying to build up your town via dice drafting and tile laying. And this one's got a really cool aspect of combos. You can really like build up your town to activate on a particular number, and then in one turn you can do like six things or whatever. It's really fun.
I've been focusing a lot on dice drafting games because I'm trying to develop one with Josh Mills, and so I've played I bought Marco Polo, Voyages of Marco Polo, Signore. We've been looking at a few other different dice drafting types of games, and this popped up, but I hadn't had a chance to get a copy of it yet, so I definitely want to try it out.
Yeah, Pioneer Days is a really cool aspect where everyone drafts a die, and then there's a leftover one, which has an effect.
Oh, I like that.
Old West Empresario also has that. I didn't know Marco Polo was dice drafting.
Well, it's dice drafting plus dice placement. So just basically interesting dice mechanics that you can do with a pool, either a personal pool or a public pool. And so I was looking at different mechanics that do those things, and obviously those are highly rated games. So, but yeah, I'd love to try it. Pioneer Days. All right, Daryl, what you been up to?
Playing some more Star Wars Destiny. It's just a fun little filler thing. And then geek thing, which makes everyone roll their eyes with, a new set from Magic the Gathering came out called Dominaria. And it's kind of returning to the original plane that the game all started with Alpha and Beta. And with that nostalgia boost, they brought Richard Garfield back to design the entire set. And it's really good. It's probably everyone's saying it's one of the best sets in the last, 10 years of the game.
Does it have, kaiju monsters in the middle that you, roll to, get damage to?
It does! It's got the rock, paper, scissors mechanic!
Magic had giant kaiju before it was cool, man.
Yeah, yeah. he brought this... I'm not going to go into how to play Magic because this podcast would be twice as long. But he brought in a new idea that's called a saga, and it's more or less an enchantment. So when it comes out on the battlefield, it stays there. But it levels up to three levels, and then it's immediately discarded. So it's pretty cool because it's like an enchantment that has like one effect on turn one, second effect on turn two, third effect on turn three, and then it's out. So and obviously the ability ratchets up. So you're the opposing team, you want to destroy it before the turn three thing happens. So
that's really cool sounding. And anyone who says that, what we say, anyone who rolls their eyes at Magic, like you were saying, can take a seat because Magic is great.
Thank you. That's kind of been it. I'm really sorry. I'm a terrible game designer and gamer because I haven't been playing games much lately. And International Tabletop Day, as I tweeted out, I was flying drones and barbecuing. I didn't come inside at all.
It was a gorgeous day. And you don't feel bad about that because I went to Atomic Empire for a hot second just for Tabletop Day because I wanted to see who was there. Also wanted to pick up Wonderland from Daniel Solis, which I'll talk about in a minute. They, for whatever reason, said they'd already sold out of their four copies that they got. And I'm like, how did you only get four copies? Because, it's Daniel and he's local. So I tweeted it out and I said, okay, come to Atomic Empire for Tabletop Day. But unfortunately, they don't have any copies of Wonderland. And all of a sudden, I guess... It was Jennifer, the owner, or somebody who was behind the account, said, oh, we've got other copies somewhere. Hold on, I'm looking into it, and found nine more copies. So Josh Mills was able to go and pick up one for me and him. And then, so on Tabletop Day, I was at Atomic Empire for really a hot second, and I got two 15-minute games on the table for the entire day. The rest of the day, I was doing what you were doing. I went to Saxpa Hall and had beer and hung outside and everything. So it was a good day.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was a long rambling story. By the way, very much on point, both with the song and with you, Daryl, because now that they've gone back to Dominaria and they've brought back Richard Garfield, they're going back to the well. So I like how you tied that into our,
our podcast. I
do. Yep. Totally on purpose, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. He's a pro.
Been paying him royalties for years. They have to at least get him to work a little bit.
I don't think a podcast has gone by where he hasn't mentioned Magic.
Not recently, yeah. Yeah.
It is true. All right, TC, what you been up to?
I don't know. I was like, this is like me and Daryl high-fiving because this I'm gonna say this is the podcast in between the podcast with quotes around it, right? And that's the podcast in between like anything cool happening that would cause anything me to else play cool happening. So I want everybody out there who's listening to hopefully you've all had a really boring last 2 weeks, because I had a really boring last 2 weeks, and the next 2 weeks though are going to be really exciting, and then as we move into convention season, it's going to be even more exciting too. So I'll have a lot more gaming stories and all that stuff later, but like for right now, it's just me sitting at a computer designing stuff, and then I went to one designer night this weekend, which was actually, it's always fun, but like getting a chance to get Maastricht on the table, and also one that I'm helping develop now, and getting that blind tested while I was playing Maastricht was pretty fun. So that is awesome. Hey, but that's what I've been doing. I do the design stuff. Like me and Daryl are just so studious.
You're so head in the books. You just don't have time for this outside world thing. Right, exactly. No. Mm-hmm. Well, I hear you.
I'm with you guys with not playing a lot of games on tabletop day. I actually was up in Phoenix for my cousin's son's bar mitzvah, so that pretty much took all day. However, I did get one game in, and that was at the party. They had this giant, like, double foosball table that was, like, two foosball tables connected.
That's awesome.
I think the intent was to... What's that?
By the goal,
not,
like you have
it's
to
not like a
goal.
Foosball centipede. No, it's side by side, probably.
It was like, yeah, you like cut off the right goal on one, left goal on the other, put them together so it's twice as long, right? And I think the idea was that you would play it like two people on each side at a time. But I played it one on one with my wife. It was awesome. We're like, kick the ball over here and then run over here, literally run down like a couple of steps over and then pick it up over here. It was more fun than I expected, actually, to try to play giant foosball.
That sounds nice. Awesome. Yeah, I was just picturing when TC was describing that of like the longest table in the world. You know, you got to go through one goal and then bring it to the other one and get back and forth. You'd never score a point. I mean, it's hard enough to score points in foosball.
Yeah, you got to score 2 points to get one goal, right?
Yeah,
he's got to try harder. He's got to play better.
You got to get good.
Twice as good as your opponent.
All right, so what I've been up to, I talked a little bit about my tabletop day escapades. Wow, those are tough to say. So let me talk about those first before I rewind for a minute. So Wonderland from Daniel Solis, obviously local designer, also the designer of Bill of the Ball. Wonderland literally plays in about 5 minutes. It says it on the back of the box, it's 5 minutes for two players. And it's just a set of 18 cards. And you're going to love this, TC. So what you're going to do is you're going to play as one player is playing as the Red Queen, one player is playing as Alice. You have a number of cards in your hand from 1 to 7. And so you're going to be playing in Wonderland, which is a 3x3 grid. So that automatically...
Okay.
But this is actually a 3x3 grid that works pretty well. It's very interesting. So the Red Queen is going to begin by placing a card face down in their section of the Wonderland, the edge of their Wonderland, which is along one edge. And then Alice will put one face down along the top of the other edge. And then you'll continue doing that with three cards that will intersect all the 9x9 grid in Wonderland. Then you take turns placing face-up cards in there. And some of the cards have, like, potions on them. Some of them have cake. So if you remember, the potion made Alice small and the cake made Alice bigger. So the potion, if it's pointing toward another card, when you try to score that row, that card has no rank. So it doesn't count toward the scoring. If it's a cake, it doubles the rank. And so you can create these cool, kind of cool combos. So after you've played all of the cards into the grid, there'll be one space left that's blank. You flip over all the face down cards, and then you try to score the rows and columns based on the amount of rank there is. So if the Red Queen has two cards there that adds up to 13, and Alice only has like 4, then the Red Queen wins whatever the card rank signifier is at the top of that row or column. So it's really kind of cool. It's, you don't know what the actual scoring is, so you're just kind of trying to double guess, but you know where your scoring is. So if you put like the 7 card out at the top and you're playing Alice, you want to try to get that 7 column. But you got to be sneaky about it, because if you're putting a card out there first, then the Red Queen's going to know, oh, you must really want that. Or maybe you're double bluffing, you know. So it's got a lot of metagame into it for just 18 cards, which I'm pretty impressed with about that. It also has a little mini expansion with it. It introduces 4 cards that have special things that change the game state, which I haven't had a chance to play with yet. But I really enjoyed it. It's a $10 game. It's a rabbit, basically.
Okay, a small box then.
Yeah, it's pretty small.
That reminded me a little bit of Kachina or Voluspa, if you've played those.
I have not. Voluspa I've heard of. I've not heard of Kachina.
Well, it's the same thing. It's just got reprinted.
Just reprinted as Voluspa.
Yeah. Yeah, they had it's a tile laying thing where some of the tiles affect the neighboring tiles. Like if you makes the next one's level zero, value zero or something.
No, I like the concept of that. I'm not big into tile laying or the card grid type of thing, but this one played so quick and just had interesting effects that were, it created a metagame in such a small package that I really liked it. So I like games that do that. There are a few button shy games that do that as well. What's that, TC? I see you grinning.
Oh, no, I'm just a big fan of 3x3 grid, so I'm just waiting to see what other designers do in the 3x3 grid space.
I think what we need to do is have a Dice Hate Me 3x3 challenge.
Oh, God.
And then TC has to judge all of them.
No, you had the Dice Hate Me 3x3 grid challenge.
You're right.
It was the 54-card challenge.
You're absolutely right. There was
at least a third.
I guess
3x3
I'm...
grid. And that's the inside joke for anybody that's listening, right? Like, I don't actually hate 3x3 grid games. It's just that when we were looking at all the 54 card challenge games, if you had that, you pretty much put yourself in the "we're not probably looking at you" pile, because it was just a very easy, like, oh, 3x3 grid again, cool,
right? It was just so many of them, and it's like, I mean, and hey, 3x3 grids, they can work, you know. 4x4 grids, oh wow, we're getting fancy. But
I don't know.
So luckily Dan and I went with a 2x3 grid so as not to
oh, but that's just the contract layout. So that's not the core of Olive Trains. It has nothing to do with all that 3x3. Anyway, so it's fun. It was a neat thing to pick up for Tabletop Day. I'm glad I was able to get a copy. I also played the other, it was only a 15-minute game, which is I got the delivery of Pigment from Copper Frog Games. So to them by Michael Epstein. It was one that I backed on Kickstarter. It got delivered last week. Basically, you have two little apprentices. You send them out into these ever-rotating markets that get you cubes. You use the cubes to paint paintings. The latest painting you get gives you a special power until you cover it up with another painting, and you race to be the first person to get 6 paintings. That's it. Very simple, straightforward, plays super easy in about 15 minutes. It's cute. It has a charm to it. It's not overly complex, so if somebody's looking for something that's really portable, it has a little bag. Again, both of them, oddly enough, had little baggies that you can use that you basically put the game in, put it in your pocket, like a certain dice game that we sold years ago. But anyway, except these aren't flammable. They aren't doused in kerosene. Yet another inside joke that we won't explain. So,
Pigment, Pastiche, or Bob Ross? Which one would you pick?
I haven't played Bob Ross yet.
Yeah, I don't think
you haven't played Bob Ross.
I want to play Art of Chill, and I still haven't got a chance to yet. It looks cool. It looks a lot of fun. I mean, out of the two between Pigment and Pastiche, obviously I'd play Pastiche. It's just a great game.
I mean, Bob Ross comes with a Bob Ross Eeple.
It's true. And that is important.
Yeah, it's Bob. Or Bob Eagle. Moves along his Bob track.
His Bob track. I love that. All right. So backing up for a little bit, the previous week, JR and Victoria Mann came and to stay at my house. They were doing the Fireball Island tour, and they went to Atomic Empire that night. But after they were through at Atomic Empire, they came back to the house, and we played a full 4-player game through. I played it with JR, played it with Ruth Boyack, and with Lillian, and I did a video playthrough of it. So if you're interested in checking out how Fireball Island plays, by the time this podcast airs, if you listen to it on the day it drops, it'll probably have about 2 days left. If you haven't heard of Fireball Island by now, I mean, you just haven't been paying attention or listening to the podcast.
Fireball.
So can't go a podcast without that one. It's great. I'm having a blast with it. JR and I also tested out the 2-player game variant that they were playing around with, and made some suggestions and notes about that. So they've gotten in a lot of great plays. The 4-player one was a blast. Came right down to the wire. I was able to make this cool combo to get onto the helicopter. We played with every expansion, including the Crimson Cutlass, which I didn't get a chance to play with at PAX East, which is the shipwreck that you can only access through caves and things. Super fun. Anyway, go check that out. It's on my YouTube channel. Go to YouTube/, I guess it's Dice Hate Me, but you can search for Dice Hate Me on YouTube, and you'll check out the playthrough video. It's about a little under an hour. And other than that, I've been playing lots of prototypes like everybody else, but mine have been other people's prototypes, which is for the Cardboard Edison Awards judging, which I'll talk a little bit more about that in game news.
Sweet. Other people's prototypes. OPP.
OPP.
Chris, I hear he's down with OPP.
I am. I've been down with OPP a lot lately. So, all right. Well, before we move on to the meat of the podcast, or game news anyway, let's talk a little bit about what...
You know what really grinds my gears?
All right, since we have a guest here, he had a ton. Maybe he's feeling really grumpy, but we're going to let him go first, and we actually stole a couple of his that we're going to turn into our grinds our gears. Yeah. So, Seth, why don't you tell me what grinds your gears?
All right. So, as you guys know, and maybe your listeners know, I am a game developer as well as a game designer and other hats that I wear. So I don't know if this will stir up any pots or whatever, but it might be a little controversial, but... One thing that really grinds my gears is when people on the topic of the role of a developer, which is something that I feel like I do, and so it means a lot to me what the role of developer is. When someone describes that role and what they describe sounds to me like just an insightful playtester, like someone who just makes comments or asks questions in the service of the designer's vision of the game, but doesn't actually test any changes or tweaks or propose any fundamental changes to the game because, oh, that's the designer's vision. Like, I don't know. To me, that sounds like what a playtester does, not what a developer does. And as somebody who does develop games and put maybe more work into it than apparently I should, that kind of grinds my gears.
Well, I would say TC, because you're going to jump into this too, and I know, but I just want to clarify to everybody that what Seth says about his role as a developer, though, is that he goes above and beyond most what any developer does. So... Ever since I've known him, like when it comes to be a game, he's going to touch every aspect of that game and get it on the table and possibly change portions of it. Not change the game from the heart of it, because a developer's role is not to change the game completely. It is to make it better. But anyway, go ahead, TC. I'm going to let you follow up on that.
Oh, no. I mean, I was just going to say, it's like I tend to consider a lot of the harder ones to be more like negotiations. It's more like... You are because, OK, so I was put in a situation where like almost levels of developing was created around me at one point. Right. And so I'm developing a game and then they were farming out like someone to play test and develop in that sense. Just play test, play test, play test. And the thing was getting that weird feeling of like being in between someone who is actually like play testing the game a gazillion times and then giving feedback and then making those changes and applying them as a developer is just such a weird thing because you're like right in the middle. But like half the time it's like it depends on the game designer. Like it's either going to be like I'm going to actively debate with you over things that need to change, like, and have a, you know, you kind of have to have an ego about it, and it's like a ego battle. And then the other half of it is like, I don't know, just playing a game and going, oh yeah, this is pretty good. You know, and I'm not really doing anything to it because you don't want to change. Like, it's just some people change things for the sake of changing things. And I think the weird thing that I get from people who are maybe Seth can give some more advice on this. But the weird thing I get from people who do playtest and then give you feedback, if you're in the role of the developer, the people who are playtesting, they tend to want to like do things more. Like, they want to change the game up from its like fundamental roots. If there's something wrong. And I don't think that's really the job of the developer. And I think playtesters that do that are kind of at a weird position, right? And the developer has to sift through that and not let that happen and then give the designer feedback that gets rid of that weird, like, I'm going to take this and gut this game. So yeah, there's a lot more to a developer than just, like, playtesting. So it's hard, yeah.
Yeah, so TZ, you bring up a good point, which is that so oftentimes, and this is something you hear from a lot of designers, when you playtest a game with some playtester, and they might say, like, maybe they like more heavier strategy games, so they'll say, oh, you should take out any die rolls or whatever, and that'd be cooler if it were, I don't know, deterministic or whatever this mechanic is. And the developer or the designer needs to decide, well, am I trying to make a heavier strategy game, or is that guy just like strategy more? And you got to filter the comments. And I see what that is. But the thing is this: so development is actually relatively young as a role. As a game development has not been around all that long. The first time I ever heard anyone's name in conjunction with a developing and developer's name in connection with a game was in 2008 when Dominion came out. And every time I heard the word Dominion, it wasn't just Dominion by Donald X. Vaccarino. It was Dominion by Donald Vaccarino and developed by Dale and Valerie, who were did third party development on that game. And before that, I'd never even heard of it. And even since then, I haven't barely heard of it until recently. And now recently, I know some people have been getting jobs, either freelance developing for designers, I guess, or for publishers, or actually getting jobs at publishing companies being a developer. And TC, maybe you did a little bit of development, or are you doing, or something?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing now, and that's you know, working with Renegade and just now consulting with Artana. But like you know, and it's a weird position, right? Like it's interesting because you get to be hands-on with the designers and everything, but like in the end, it's not your game. It's sort of it's got to be a product too, and so like the considerations that you make aren't like, you know, if I was just an insightful playtester, like you say, like if it all boils down to me just playtesting a game and going, oh, I think you should change this one thing, that's great. It's, sometimes it does happen that way, but like It's just because the game is very, very solid when given to you. But sometimes games are just like, they're somewhere in that middle ground. Usually games are in that middle ground, and there's more than just that. You need to like go back and actually play this change or make the suggestion based off of feedback that you got and change in the middle of the game. I don't know. But yeah.
So that's, and it kind of depends on your goal. If you're, I mean, like you're talking about working for a publisher who's publishing a game, it needs to meet their requirements in their market and their demographic and everything like that, which is a bit different than like if a designer who had a game that was not currently signed or whatever wanted to hire a developer or something to help them make it better, quote unquote, like better for who, I guess, is might be a question. So that's a little bit of a different situation. But what the way I look at it, and I think Chris touched on this a little bit earlier, is I don't look to change the game. I just look to try to bring out what I thought the designer was trying to do. And if that means scrapping their mechanic in one respect and rebuilding it from scratch, then I do that. I don't necessarily, or I try it maybe. I don't think, this isn't working quite the way I think it is, so maybe I'll put a Band-Aid on it and see if I can make it work a little better. Instead, I'd dismantle it and then try to build something that I think does what they were trying to do, in my opinion. So that's, I don't know, that's kind of how I approach it. But yeah, so development's weird. And it might be the case that we need more terminology, right? Like maybe so many different definitions of developer and so many different implications. Like I think we could do well to have a different word for
maybe different categories of developer, because I think the word developer is apropos. I think that it makes sense as to what, you know, we do in that respect. But you're right in that there's different roles. You know, I'll look at a game and try to develop it not only for the best it can be mechanically wise or how it plays, but also how it fits into the aesthetic of the company, how it's going to fit into the marketplace. Different portions of that game that we can highlight and bring out that's going to make the game more palatable to a certain type of gamer or a wider base of demographics. So there's a lot of different aspects that goes into development, and it's an interesting art to try to balance all those different aspects. But there, and like you said, there are different portions of things. Like for instance, if a designer hires a developer to help their game make their game better, that developer is only going to focus on the game and not where the game goes afterwards, or where it's going to fit into a certain company. So yeah, this could be a whole podcast on itself, which I think is awesome. And it's great for talking about that, but we're not ranting enough, I don't think, for what grinds my gears.
Right.
All right. Well, Daryl, do you have something that grinds your gears?
Well, I have a couple things, but I will go with the one that I was told to go with.
I'm developing Daryl's podcast.
He is. He just made my rant better. My rant was going to be about how if you own a game and you haven't played it, don't go publicly and say, you know what would fix this game?
Oh, see, I'm glad you said that too, because it was almost mine, but I didn't know if I wanted to go there. But yeah, anyway.
That sounds like oddly specific.
we'll leave that for now. Just move on. It's safer to move on to the next one.
I absolutely love it. They love it so much. I love it when someone says, oh, it's just a Kickstarter game.
Yeah.
Period.
Like, in what context do you mean? Like to excuse crappiness?
Yeah. Or you know, I expected this and I expected that, but, you know, what else can I expect? It's just a Kickstarter game. As if, like, it's less than a normal game because it was on Kickstarter. Okay.
I can totally agree with this gear grinding.
I'm going to go super specific here. And Chris will also jump in with some of the additional details. But there was a review for one of my games, and it's a game that I'm incredibly proud of. I'm proud of all my games, but this one I'm incredibly proud of. And he pointed out some issues and some personal flaws he felt. Cool. You know, I have no problem with bad reviews. I can take them. But it was the line, but what do I expect? It was just a Kickstarter game. And it was like, what?
So derogatory. So unnecessary too. It's like, why even say that? It was not. That doesn't mean anything. Just because it's on Kickstarter, I'm taking over your rant here, Daryl. But just because it's on Kickstarter doesn't mean that it's an inferior game. Matter of fact, and a lot of times they stay in longer development cycles than the crap that's pushed out, you know, for mainstream, especially IP.
Teach it like a preacher, Kirkman.
Especially IP crap that's pushed out on the scene. Like somebody gets an IP, so you got a year to put a game out. Well, I'm going to take a crap in a box and put a mask on it and put it out on the shelf, you know, or whatever. Anyway. That's all I'm saying. That's part of my rant of Daryl's rant. But anyway, so.
I understand that there are Kickstarter games where people just say, hey, I have an idea. I'm going to throw it on Kickstarter and get it made. And then three felonies later, they find out, no, it's just a bad game. And so...
Yeah, that's an inside joke, too. But anyway.
This has been a complaint ever since... I don't know, 2012 or so. Soon after Kickstarter became a thing, people started... whiny complaining that there's no gatekeeper anymore. Anyone can put anything on Kickstarter. And I have always been of the opinion that, you know what? Regardless of Kickstarter, you can go into the store and look on the shelf and find a crappy game. Like, there's no reason that has to go through Kickstarter to become crappy. That's it's not right. Like the gatekeepers were, quote-unquote, doing such a good job anyway, right?
Those people were always around. It's just one person had the money, and now anyone can get the money. That's the only difference.
Yeah, and I... caveat, I would say with anyone, well, not a caveat really, but anyone shopping on Kickstarter should do the same as if they were shopping on the shelf of the store, is it would behoove them to look into it and see if it's a game they're going to like. Don't just be like, ooh, it's on Kickstarter. Click.
The things people back on Kickstarter just...
It baffles me.
Insane.
Yes.
And then people complain about Kickstarter. You're like, well, you could just not give them the money, like, and then their dream is dead. And that's good, because some dreams should just die.
there was three weeks ago or so, there were two, and I mean, I'm not going to toss out names, but there were a couple of Kickstarter projects. Not necessarily all tabletop, but there were a couple of Kickstarter projects that had, like, $80,000 thrown out that I'm like, why? Why is this happening? Like, where is this money coming from, and why isn't it going toward... Anyway, that's another rant completely, but... We've had several Kickstarter rants, which is fine.
I'm sure every podcast has had several Kickstarter rants per week. If I could piggyback on Daryl's just for a moment, though, and to extend it to say that people who complain that one Kickstarter project, like Exploding Kittens, for example... is taking up all the money and their friend's indie game isn't going to fund, which is, and their friend's indie game is like a 3-hour epic strategy game or something like that. And this is not really what Daryl was saying, but like, I guess it's related. I don't think any of the people that backed Exploding Kittens would have backed that other game had Exploding Kittens not existed. But people seem to say, oh, you're taking up all the money, whatever. Like,
yeah, we've definitely talked about,
and these aren't the same thing.
We've definitely talked about that before, and TC is of that opinion as well. He's like, you know, it's bringing more people into Kickstarter. So it's like, okay, well, that's more vision to Kickstarter in general. So the Exploding Kittens, and I don't really, see, here's the thing. I don't fault Exploding Kittens for making a bunch of money. It was the Oatmeal. It's a great brand. Is going to a really cool person and an individual and an entity and people who were behind the game, tools, stuff like that. And they had a great booth at Gen Con, by the way. But now, the thing that kills me and grinds my gears is that because of Exploding Kittens, now we've got Bears versus Babies, and we've got unicorns with, you know, star hooves, and just like all this weird, stupid stuff that's hitting Kickstarter, and people are like, ooh, maybe that's the next Exploding Kittens. That looks cute. Bam! Money. Right down the tubes. Anyway.
So my going back to my thing, Hi guys, yeah. That was my topic.
It was only your topic in name only. It was really Chris's to begin with.
It really is. But it's very much, just kind of think about it. Like, believe me, any designer that's on Kickstarter, really wishes they could do it without Kickstarter. And especially ones that, have, I say, proven themselves to be good designers. Like, but it's not the designer's company or method of getting the game out. It's all the publisher's call. So don't judge a game just based on if it's on Kickstarter or not, because maybe that's the only way the publisher can get the game out to your attention.
And we will talk a bit about more of that when I talk about what grinds my gears in a second. So TC, why don't we take a small break in this Kickstarter madness and tell us what grinds your gears.
Anyone who reviews Infinity Wars poorly,
buckle your seatbelts. No, I'm just kidding.
No. So I got out of Infinity War the other night on Thursday. I had a great time. I think the movie was awesome. I'm sorry. I think the film was awesome.
The film. It is a film. It is a oeuvre.
No, I thought it was awesome. It was kind of like this culmination of all the things. And for the fact that, like, they've been doing this stuff for years, and I'm really, really excited to see Marvel movies. Like, it's just like every time a superhero movie comes out, it's like I kind of just have to watch it because it ends up being good, even like against all odds. Like, all of them just end up being good. And so when they all come together and they just are this big group and they do this main event kind of thing, I've just never seen that before. And it was just such a spectacle and so awesome. And then I knew getting out of it, I'd be like, I would just assume that like the whole world could just agree, I can at least give this a 3 out of 5. Like, 3 out of 5 stars, I can totally do this. And I look, and I know I'm going to look on Rotten Tomatoes the second I get out of the theater, and it's going to be somewhere, like, below 90%, right? Like, and I'm just going to say to myself, like, this should be 100%. Like, Paddington 2 and children's films and documentaries all get 100%, right? And the reason why they get 100% is because they're children's movies, and everyone just goes, oh, it's a kid's movie, it doesn't matter if it's good. And if it's a documentary, it's like, I don't know anything about this subject, and it made me learn.
Well, they're all like, oh, wow, look how smart I am because I really like this thing. Right, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not going to walk out of Infinity War and go, wow, I learned so much. My brain is so big now. Unless it's about geekdom and Marvels. Yeah.
I learned so much about myself. Anyway, so I had a really good time watching this movie, and I think it's like universally liked, and I think anyone who says, like, oh, well, I'm going to be that guy that just trashes this movie, literally pathetic. You are a pathetic individual. You should go watch it. Like, and if this is not your thing, then of course, don't go watch it. But if you come out of it and you're like, I didn't watch any of the Marvel movies, and then I watched Infinity War, I don't even know what's going on.
Well, that's just somebody being stupid. Yeah.
Sit back. go hang out with your friends and drink wine and I don't know, be a troll on the internet somewhere and just go off and live by yourself, be a hermit, because I think almost everybody should like this movie. It's just good. It's just really interesting and cool, and I just loved it. I had
that was
time.
One thing when Leslie and I saw it, when we walked out of the theater, she was trying to talk to me, and I'm going, wait till we get in the parking lot, because other people were going into it, and I didn't want anything to be spoiled.
Yeah,
like, this is not one you want to have spoiled. But the one thing she mentioned, and I didn't even think about it, was, she said, if you didn't see the other Marvel movies, they didn't name a lot of characters. It was just like the people on stage, like, hey, what's up? It's you! Like, hugs! Yeah! Let's do this! And, like, never said their names, and it, like normal people would. Like I don't say, hi, Christopher Kirkman. Hi, T.C. Petty. Hi, Seth Jaffe. How are you? Let's play this game. Oh, T.C., you're so funny. It's not so overly served. And this was very much, you don't know anything, you're going to be very lost in the first 5 minutes. Incredibly lost.
That's one of the issues, though. As somebody who hasn't kept up with the Marvel films, I was like, I'd love to go see Infinity War, but like, I'm not going to know what's going on, so I'm not going to see it. And, I'm back. I'm like, I think I saw half of Winter Soldier And I've been trying to wait till I can finish that before I watch.
Only see half of some? I mean, Winter Soldier.
I had to go somewhere. It was on TV or something, and I had to go somewhere, and then my TV broke.
No, it's fine. But I look at it like I honestly like I love walking. Like my favorite thing to do is to see like the sequel to a movie before I've seen the first. Because you walk in, no, and it's like legitimately, you walk in and everyone's so confident. It's like they know each other so well, and they're like, they have these relationships already set up, and you just immediately immersed in the world, as opposed to them feeling out their characters, and sometimes the acting's weird, and like, no, it's like you step in and you're in their world, and you better get ready. And I feel like Infinity War felt like that. There's some stuff that some threads I didn't know anything about, but it didn't matter. It was like,
have you seen all the other Marvel movies leading up to it? All the Thor movies and all the Captain America movies and all that? Have you seen all that, TZ?
I didn't see the last Thor. Yeah,
so, okay.
I saw bits and pieces of it.
See, that was interesting.
I didn't see a few of them. So.
Yeah,
because I guess movies in general, though, I mean, like, there can be good sequels and bad sequels. If you go into a sequel... Well, like, for example, the Harry Potter movies, like, I liked them at first, but when they, you know, later in the series... I haven't read the books and I got really lost and I was like complaining about it. And my friend was like, oh, well, if you read the book, that would totally make sense. And I'm like, what do I got to do, homework to watch a movie? Like, this should make sense. It's not like I saw like Harry Potter number five without seeing the first four.
You know? And, I guess, you know, to interrupt you blatantly, I guess to do the, like, that just is where my mind is, right? Like, so the Harry Potter movies, I think, the first one definitely was scattershot. Like it didn't know how to introduce characters. It was just a little bit weird and rushed, right? But after the second one, you get to the third and the fourth and fifth and sixth, it kind of just, I felt like they were their own thing. And yes, there was pieces missing, but they filled in those gaps well for me. So it's like, but that's the thing. Like I embrace the immersiveness of the world. And so when someone like, I just love in Infinity Wars and Harry Potter and everything. I just love the banter that they have with the characters.
Sure.
Right.
I feel like you're talking about more about the actors and the characters and the interpersonal relationships, which I suspect I agree with you on, where I'm talking more like the story or the storytelling of the movie. Like I literally fell asleep in one of the Harry Potter movies. Cause I didn't know what was going on, and I guess I was tired. And then I woke up halfway through it, and I thought it was about when one of the Lord of the Rings movies was out, because I woke up halfway through it, and I'm like, what? Gollum is pulling someone down into the water, and, like, Gandalf is standing on the edge? But no, it was actually, like, one of the Horcrux scenes or whatever in Harry Potter. But I thought it was pretty funny.
Spoilers!
I'm like, this looks like Lord of the Rings. Did I wake up in like the next movie?
It does look a little bit, yeah.
But like you said, Seth, it's, you wouldn't see Harry Potter without seeing the first four.
I would see it without
Infinity War is very, I think, very much like that. You wouldn't see that without at least seeing at least one of every other IP or other characters standalone movie. Because then it all kind of makes sense.
Right. And the fact that I'm kind of behind, now it feels almost overwhelming. I have to watch like 12 hours of movies before I can go see this new movie that just came out. By the time I'm done with that, there'll be spoilers everywhere because it's like, you know, everyone's like, what? You didn't see that yet? You know, or whatever. I don't know.
No, everybody. I can give you a list. Basically, because it's the Infinity War, so it's about the Infinity Stones. Like, that's a known thing. If you watch the movies and I can give you the list that involve the Infinity Stone, then you're kind of caught up.
Yeah, but sure. but I would say literally, if you had no clue, because I had no idea what they were talking about with these things. I was like, why does that guy have that? I saw the last Avengers movie and I was still like, what is that thing in his head? Why does he have that? And why is that related to this plot? I don't think anyone needs to know anything going into this. I think you could go in completely blind and still have a really good time.
I think so too.
But
I will say
it's much better as a payoff for all the people that have done this. And I think it actually is good. Like on top of it just being like this way crazy thing that's going on, the performances, the acting, I mean, it's just super solid. Everything is super solid.
I've heard nothing but good about this movie. So that's good. And I've also, you know, like people are saying Marvel's figured it out. They know how to make a movie now. But so they, I'm not surprised. I'm sure it's good.
Well, all right. Before the Russo brothers, Marvel did started getting a little formulaic, where it's like, okay, this, it's this formula again. Like Iron Man is Iron Man fighting an evil Iron Man. You know, and Thor's fighting an evil Thor, like somebody with the same powers, and it's just like, oh, so they're battling. Like, yeah. Super Soldier fights Super Soldier. This fights this. You know, Black Panther fights Golden Jaguar, which is also Black Panther, but for some reason he's yellow. And, you know, it's that kind of stuff. Yeah. But it's that. And then thankfully, the Russos, starting with Winter Soldier, that was their first one, they made it a political thriller, and the formula was broken. And pretty much everything they touch, there's no formula to it. It's completely different. I don't know. I really like what they're doing for it. And this movie is probably one of the better ones they've done, or any of the Marvel movies.
So that's reassuring. Could I have two small comments I can make about movies, one about superhero movies in general and one about movies in general that would be relating to this grinding gears.
Let me remind everybody out there that this is a board gaming podcast and not a movie podcast. You want to listen about movies, tune into Geek All Stars, but we're going to take this moment. Go ahead, Seth, because I want to hear your thoughts.
All right. So just really quickly, the thing about these Avenger movies and stuff, when it comes to superhero movies, I much prefer the ones where, like, it's this one unique character who's larger than life for, you know, some reason. There's a little, you know, like Spider-Man when he, okay, whatever, radioactive spider, assume that, and then the rest of the movie is great. But like Avengers, where everyone's a superhero, like, kind of isn't interesting to me. Like, I don't know. It's like, oh, everyone and their mother has got superpowers. It, like, doesn't
exactly. Yeah, but they don't. Most of them don't have superpowers.
Black Widow doesn't. Tony Stark doesn't.
Sure, Cap, but Cap
all,
doesn't.
All
I mean,
super awesome.
Cap doesn't all, like, either. He's only the heroes. Pinnacle of the human. Like, he's got a little bit of the super serum in him. Anyway, yeah. It's fine.
He's super speed, older, right? Super strength.
But he's not super. I mean, he's not super he's human. Super
like he's
no. He's
than
the
average,
ultimate
right?
Like, human. Is what he is. What Cap is.
Last so thing I want to say about okay.
Oh, I was saying, like, Spider-Man, I thought was, like, one of the better movies, and, like, Avengers, I was like, eh. I mean, it wasn't terrible, I just didn't like all the superheroes together.
Was that the first Avengers? Was that the first Avengers?
Yeah, like, the first Avengers when it had, like, all the superheroes together, whatever.
See, that was where, it, like, TC said, oh, they're all getting comfortable with each other. The second one, I just finished Age of Ultron earlier today, and it's funny because there's a lot of foreshadowing about the third Avengers, which is the one in theaters right now, a lot, and I'm like, I missed all of this. And of course, you wouldn't even know it because it's just, oh, they're just talking about this. And now it's like, holy crap.
Well, they've been building up to the Infinity War since the beginning. So they set it all up.
I do appreciate that they planned ahead. So that's good.
More than that, and I'll talk to it when you're not recording about how much foreshadowing.
Okay.
The fact that we rewound it and we're like, did they really just say that? Like, holy crap. But anyway, the last thing I want to say about Infinity War was the CGI is so good.
Like, it's Thanos, pretty good. Anybody can make Thanos emote that much. Pretty darn good.
Man. I was like, is that prosthetics or what? Like, the close-ups, everything. Like, every single muscle in his face was constantly moving. It wasn't a computer-generated. It was better than Gollum and Smeagol. I mean, it was crazy good.
I didn't know he was CGI. I just was, like, going with it.
There you go.
I don't know. I mean, I just assumed it was some guy with prosthetics on.
Just some guy. Just some Josh Brolin with prosthetics with a big scrot on his face.
Yep.
Well, so, TC, was Infinity War like some of these other recent movies that are, I feel, are just, like, rushing from one scene to the next, and it kind of, like, doesn't feel epic anymore to me. Like, Ready Player One was like that. The book seemed cool because, like, stuff took place over time, and plot developed over time, and people had to, like, sink in, and, like, their actions had to, like, sink in. They had to figure stuff out and whatever. But this was like, the movie was like, what, it lasted a day? I don't know. And it just didn't seem like it had as much gravitas. So are these new movies from Marvel, are they, like, rushing from one scene to the next, or is there some, like, development?
What I like about it is that they take their time. Like, I mean, it's almost a 3-hour movie, honestly. And it could have been, I mean, it could have gone 4 hours and I still would have been sitting there. It would have been fine. I was assuming it would be like 4 hours given how much stuff they've done with all these characters. But it had a bit of the like hectic pace. Like, you definitely, because you have to cut between like 5 different epic scenes going on. So yes, there is that, but there is what I liked about it so much was that there was so much downtime to allow characters to just have a conversation. Like, there was multiple times where, like, they just had a conversation unrelated to, like, well, I mean, somewhat related, but non-sequitur conversations were going on between these different matchups of superheroes. And it was just great as a payoff to people who have been watching, like, superheroes forever to just see your favorite characters have these interactions that, like, they could never possibly have before this moment. And so, I mean, and that's, you know, and that's what's really, to me, was, like, really cool was the downtime. Any of the downtime in that movie was awesome. It was just, that was the best. Two people talking. Best part of that movie. And it's because when someone walks onto the screen, this is so ridiculous. This podcast.
This podcast is off the rails, but go ahead.
But when someone walks on the screen, you immediately, you see their character, right? And I don't necessarily know how they're going to react or emote to a situation. And it's always kind of a surprise. Then, and another character will talk to them given their character traits. And so many of these characters, I didn't even realize how boldly different they are while being so relatable and similar. Like when a Tony Stark, who's like ego-driven scientist, walks into the room and he's talking to Doctor Strange, you're like, these two characters are very similar, but they are so different. They are so different on screen. And the way that the actors pull that off, and just even like even scenes where like Black Widow is in the movie, right? And I'm just like, even like the characters that don't have the superpowers and their interactions with other characters are just so like, that is that character. How could that character ever be anybody else? It's just, man. So that's why I would say, like, anybody who reviews it poorly, going back to the same point, I think they're just being, I'm elitist and ridiculous. Yeah. And I liked this movie. It made me feel childlike. So if it does that to me, it's kind of like, you can't really, you really have to be a troll to really the crap on this movie, right? Like, it's just an event and it's a spectacle. And
the most salient point as to how I felt about this movie, we're going to move on, was a comment on Twitter that somebody said this was essentially the giant sized annual of superhero movies. And so for comic book fans, that'll make a lot of sense, because every year there's always, there used to be, they don't really do them much anymore, but there was always the giant sized annual at the end of the year that told this epic story that involved, like, not only the team, but also sometimes crossovers and all kinds of different stuff like that. This was the giant sized annual of movies, and that's how it felt. It's epic. You're not going to get quite as much character development as like a 12 issue arc, but you got all this stuff happening in this giant-sized book. It's exactly the same thing that happened in Infinity Wars. Anyway, we're going to move on. But if you want to hear more about... If you want to hear more about Infinity War, you can probably tune in to either the Geek All-Stars or our epic crossover event where we might resurrect for one episode only, Screen Issues, to talk about Infinity War.
Yeah, but whatever happened to Screen Issues? Actually,
we just had so much going on. It was so hard to start scheduling and, you know,
one or two people would be available and no one else. We're like,
it was tough. Oh, we miss it. We really miss it. And it, go ahead.
I just want to jump back. You said there's no character development. It's the fourth sequel. The only character that needed to develop was Thanos, and they did a.
That's fine. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's a giant sized annual. Did you miss what I just told you? It's the giant sized annual of movies. Anyway, right. We are getting back to board games.
Yeah, maybe you have a board game related.
I do have a board game related thing.
Grinding of Gears.
I appropriated it from you, Seth, and it was because you put it into my thoughts exactly. You basically said you didn't know if there's anything specific, but in general, when people say that anybody shouldn't, quote, use Kickstarter or shouldn't have to, quote, use Kickstarter, I feel the same way. Like, Kickstarter is a tool. And I like this point you put down here. It says, do these people also complain when people pry a nail out of a board with a screwdriver because that wasn't the original intent of the screwdriver? It's perfect. Yeah, Kickstarter is a tool, and sometimes you use that tool either to front load and get the money you need, or sometimes you might use it as a marketing device, or sometimes you might use it to test the market of a game. Because here, let's break it down publishing-wise, get a little bit inside baseball for a second. When you make a game, let's say we're making Fate of the Elder Gods. So we know that it's a good game and we want to publish it. And but we're like, okay, well, first of all, we want to put it on Kickstarter because it's good for marketing, because that type of game is a Kickstarter type of game. When I say that, it is one that has a lot of development behind it, but story behind it is also Cthulhu mythos and Lovecraftian. It has Richard Launius behind it. It has all of us who have been in Kickstarter before. It has that pedigree. That has it going for it. So we're able to market it and get forward marketing on it because of Kickstarter, but also it allows us to see what the response was on Kickstarter to the game, so we know how many copies to order. Because you can sit around and speculate and say, like, well, this is obviously a 20,000 copy run of a game or whatever like that, and then you order 20,000 copies and you end up selling 3,000. Well, you're left with 17,000 copies. What are you going to do with them? You can push them as much as you possibly can, but they're going to sit in a warehouse and gather dust for a while. This allows you to test the market to see what kind of demand there is for a certain title. It's just a tool to use various different ways. Not only to, first and foremost, though, it is to make games happen. It is to make ideas a reality. And hopefully, like we talked about, the gatekeeping portion of that allows us to make the better games a reality. That's not always the case, but in a lot of cases, it is. I've seen a lot of really good games come to fruition through Kickstarter. I mean, I wouldn't have a company right now if it wasn't for Kickstarter. So it's like, going back to Daryl's point, like saying that, oh, it's just a Kickstarter game. So much work goes put into Kickstarter games, just as much as the one that goes into the public. And we use Kickstarter for not only the way it was intended, but also the other ways that it started to be intended since it's evolved, because everything evolves. The market evolves. The board game hobby has evolved, especially in the past like 8 to 10 years. It's just been insane about how much has evolved. If you don't evolve with that and start to use the tools you have at your disposal to make the most of that market, you will die. You will lose your company. You will not put out any more games. You will become a relic, and you will die. So you have to use all that information and tools at your disposal. That's my rant.
Yeah, I think one of the problems is that people lump Kickstarter creators all into like the same bucket when there's many different types, right? There are, like you said, there are established companies who've done it before and are making a game, and they've made 13 before or 50 or whatever. Then there's new companies who intend to be established companies and they're making like their first game. Then there's the guy who's like, oh, I had this game idea, I just want to print it, but I don't really care to like have a company. I'm not starting a company, I'm just trying to do this one game. I'm the Gloomhaven guy might be in that category, right? He made Gloomhaven. It's not like he's got a back catalog, but it, you know, whatever. There's all kinds of different like types of creators, and to lump them all together and be like, obviously this is the one thing, it doesn't make any sense. Like there's no reason to do that. Like, yeah. I don't know.
Even with CMON, a lot of people gripe about CMON using Kickstarter and so on and so forth, but they've started to adapt it. Agree with or disagree with like the hate Kickstarter, but it was a Kickstarter quote unquote exclusive or Kickstarter content exclusive, where they're going to print however many copies of it, get on Kickstarter, and then that's it. Now, granted, that's using FOMO for marketing, or fear of missing out for marketing, but that's a different way to use that tool. It's still going to bring
do that without Kickstarter, right? You could use fear of missing out without Kickstarter.
You can, absolutely.
It's not.
But it is also a new start of the evolution of how Kickstarter is used. Does that mean that it's keeping money away from these other projects? In some instances, possibly. But in most cases, it's just people who want the CMON type of game anyway, and they're just going to back it. So it's like, okay, sure, they've got this platform, they're using it. Whether you agree that it's a good way or a bad way, it is a legitimate use of Kickstarter, especially as how it's evolved now. And it's smart. It's smart business.
Well, you guys just aren't true indie creators anymore. Sorry,
we've sold out.
You fat cats can use your Kickstarter. You can use your Kickstarter money as millions, however you want to use it. But us indie creators.
Well, what's going to be interesting is we're going to return to this topic actually a little bit later when we start talking about the meat of the podcast, because we're going to get into the deluxified portions that TMG's been doing and some things that we've been doing, so on and so forth. So we'll return to that. For now, I think we have done more than enough about what grinds our gears. So now it's time for some game news. All right. So the Cardboard Edison Awards, the judging was held, the previous weekend before I went to it, was held at Chris and Suzanne Zinsley's house in Hoppetcong, New Jersey. And then we went down to Orlando for a little retreat and judged the, I believe, 15 finalists. I played I made it my goal to play every single title. I played every single title except for one, and then that's because I had already played that title in the local design on James Myers, Fire in the Library. Not Fire in the Library. Oh, my gosh. The Library is Burning. Let me correct that. The Library is Burning. And it was a lot of fun. We always have a lot of fun doing the judging for this. The winner and the first and second runner-ups have been announced. Animal Kingdoms from Stephen Aramini took the top spot, and I can definitely guarantee you right now that it is quality. It was my favorite game, and I enjoyed practically all the titles there. They all brought something interesting to the table, but Animal Kingdoms was it reminded me of, you know, like a game like Coloretto. Easy to learn, but has a lot of kind of metagame surrounding it. It looks good on the table. Every single game is going to be different because of the changing game states. And essentially, I'll just describe it really quickly. It's the only one out of the contest I'm going to describe, because you can go to cardboardedison.com/award and check out this year's winners and descriptions and videos and everything for it. But Cardboard or Animal Kingdoms is basically, there are five kingdoms that are out on the board. And you have a hand of cards that you're going to be drawn from and play into the table, four cards. And they are eight different animal types of eight different ranks. So you've got a 1 through 8 of, say, bears and 1 through 8 of octopi, things like that. So what you're doing, though, is you have these decrees that are put out underneath each of the kingdoms. And the decrees say something like the same rank or beast in this column. And so you have to play, basically, when somebody plays a card, like, let's say the eight octopi or eight octopus, the next card that somebody plays in that column has to be an eight or an octopus. And so each of the decrees, and they can play off of neighboring kingdoms. They can play off of the entire row of kingdoms. They can have all kinds of different things on them. Some limit the type of animals that you can play in that particular kingdom. Anyway, when you play a card into that particular column, you put a cube in that kingdom, and the kingdoms rank from having four spots to the very end kingdom that has eight spots, and whoever has the majority in that particular kingdom at the end gets the top points for that kingdom, and the person who has the second amount gets the second amount, and third, and so on and so forth, depending on how many players are playing the game. And then whoever decides to play the last in that kingdom gets the capital city and puts their cube up at the top of the card, and then gets a presence in that kingdom for the next round. It's played over three rounds. Whoever has the most points at the end of the game, you have to have a little bit of consideration, because if you pass first, you get to take 5 points. If you're the first person to play into the capital city, you get the capital city, but then you're out of the round as well. So it has a lot of decision making for that particular one. Anyways, super easy to play, lots of replayability. Still needs a few tweaks, which we've given a lot of good feedback to Steven. He's been very receptive to those, and I have no doubt that this game will be snagged up and signed shortly.
I'm just glad that, you know, a fellow Ion Award winner in the same year that I won another award. Although I will say, I didn't put my game, Steven, if you're listening, I didn't put my game in the Cardboard Edison Awards. We're both established designers. We should probably allow other designers that are less deserving to a chance to win these awards. Come on, man. Don't just take all the awards. All
right. Anyway, it's a good game. Everybody should check it out. I actually asked him for the print and play files. I printed my own copy. Been playing with a lot of people. It's great. Ton of fun. Second place was Rune Shaper. And this was from Matt Wynn. And he basically, it's a tile system where you have it out and you have some tiles in your hand. I'm not going to go further into it, but basically it's a tile shifting game where you're trying to complete contracts in your hands. It's very abstract. I didn't think I'd like it because it wasn't abstract, and it's also a spatial game, which I'm usually not as good at, but I rocked and rolled this game and I had a blast. We had a couple of changes that can make to open up the gameplay for it, but overall, I mean, this is a quality game, especially if you were able to make it be sort of like Azul and have these cool tiles that you shift around and move around on the table. I think it would sell really well. It was a lot of fun. Third place was Point Salad, which was from Flat Out Games. And this one was already being passed around. There were several copies of it at Unpub. People have been chomping at the bit to be able to sign this one. I have no doubt it's going to be signed. Ian Zhang wants this game like so bad. He's basically passing out every time he plays it. Anyway, a lot of fun, super easy to play. All three of the games that won this year were fairly quick games, but don't let that make it seem like that the Carbon S and Orange is not going to award something heavier, because we did have some heavier games, some of which I think have a lot of promise. Last year's game was Castell, which is a little bit of a heavier game. And so anyway, good times. Go check that out at cardboardedison.com/award. So let's move on to something else that we can all talk about, which is Wonder Dice has allegedly stolen the game design for their upcoming Alien Nostromo game. And Bruno Fedidi, among others, are not pleased. So there's an article that, it started with a thread on BGG, basically, and Bruno had brought it up, including the, what is this here? The French Union of Game Designers, the Société des Auteurs de Jeux. They released a statement supporting the designer of the original designer, who's saying that the Wonder Dice design is his design. And did you all follow this? Have you all been keeping up with this in the news? Or did you take a chance?
Yeah. A little bit. Basically, someone said that they submitted a game to a publisher. The publisher ended up not publishing it, and then later has now published a game that's almost like the same.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. This is what some designers fear. It's their greatest fear of, like, putting a game out there or trying to sign something with a publisher. The publisher looks at it. They evaluate it for a while. The publisher passes. And there's nothing to prevent that publisher from making the game themselves. There's really not. But the backlash of it happening is enough to not want anyone to do that, because what's been happening surrounding this, whether it's 100% true or not, is really, really bad for Wonder Dice. Whether it's going to be from people, already the French Game Designers Union has denounced it, so that's going to affect some of its sales. It will affect people who will work with that company in the future. As far as designers are concerned, they're going to be very reticent to work with that company again. We have a lot of self-policing in the community. Now, of course, they've had official releases from Wonder Dice. There have been releases on both sides. It becomes a little bit of the he said, he said, she said, she said type of thing. But from all the accounts and everybody else backing up from what they know about the game, they do say that the similarities are so close or close enough to be considered plagiarism. And it also, this article also mentions a couple other examples of that. Like, there was a kerfuffle not too long ago about Leader Games when they decided not to publish Sam Bailey's Deep Enemy Frontier. And Sam was not happy about that, because now portions of it apparently went into Root. And so he wanted to speak out about that. And Oink Games, which we all talked about, they were not too pleased about Bezier Games releasing Werewords. And not just because the art is not that great on the game.
I actually thought, I mean, with Werewords, when it was announced that he was doing it, I thought he had, this is the first time I'm hearing that he didn't have permission.
I agree. I thought that he did as well, but apparently there's a little bit of some little vagaries in the...
Maybe he changed the game up a little bit or something. I haven't played Werewords yet, so I can't do a basis of comparison.
I haven't played Werewords. Actually, so, as a dissenting opinion on that, so I haven't played Deep or Root or Nostromo or whatever. I don't know any about that stuff, but I did play Werewords, and I did hear at the time, my understanding was he asked for if they wanted to like partner, and Oink Games said no or something, and then he came out with Werewords anyway somehow. I don't know what would have been different if they had partnered. I don't know, but what I will say is this: I mean, I've seen Insider played, and I've played Werewords. And while the equipment is the same, it's kind of like that thing that happened with Serlin and Reiner Knizia about Flash Duel. Flash Duel was basically En-Garde, an old Knizia game, with like, that's the main mechanism, was like En-Garde. But then he's like added all these characters and all these rules and different play modes. And, you can play multiplayer, you can play all, many versus one and cooperative. Is that the same game? Is that plagiarism or whatever? Like, he's taken En-Garde, but he's added all this stuff to it. And Werewords is sort of similar. Like, Werewords is like fundamentally Insider in that you're trying to guess a word and one person knows it. But with all, it's like very much mixed with the werewolf stuff. And frankly, when you play Werewords, it's not like one person knows the word. Almost everybody knows the word. And it's mostly about trying to figure out which ones are on your team and which ones are not. So there is some similarity in that. That main mechanism is, there where you're, there's a person that knows the word and they're trying to use 20 questions to get the word out. But I might go as far as to say that I don't think Werewords is a ripoff or whatever of Insider, because I think he added quite a bit.
Cool.
That's good to know. I mean, but this goes, again, we've talked about this in the past as well. There's a difference between taking the core of something and adding on to it or making it your own, because that's just basically building upon other designs. For instance, Dominion. You know, when Dominion first came out, it was the deck building mechanism, and there were, you know, tons of Dominion clones that popped out all of a sudden. One of which, but like we'll talk about Ascension. Ascension was essentially taking the deck building mechanisms of things, but building other things around it, making it a little easier to play, much more variability as far as the market and so on and so forth that Dominion had. But nobody just jumped out and cried foul and said, well, you stole my mechanism. I mean, because that just happens. This type
it's
of thing.
Comparison, yeah.
Yeah. This is some things that happen in the actual game space that we live in, the hobby and the community. What you run into these types of situations, unfortunately, is where something is so close and the there's been no recompense for the designer that originally came up with the idea. Like, if they weren't hired for development, or they're not getting the cut of anything that they did for an idea, that's different than, okay, well, Donald X releases Dominion, makes thousands off of it from his royalties, and then all of a sudden somebody takes that and runs with it in a different direction. Yeah. That's, he's already gotten his payout from that, and Dominion still stills like hotcakes versus, you know, different things. Anyway.
Thunderstone, for example, is largely Dominion, but they just added a little bit to it, and one could say, oh, why? How come no one's saying, oh, that's just a ripoff of Dominion, you know?
Right.
Another similar thing, that Lune Architects game that was on Kickstarter, that was basically a fan-made Glenn Moore on steroids kind of thing. Are you familiar with this? Have you seen this?
Yes.
You play
it? Yeah, I haven't played it yet, but I'm familiar with what you're talking about, yeah.
I liked Glenn Moore quite a bit, so I went in on the Lune Architects thing to check it out. It came. I've only played it like once or twice, but I did think it was, I mean, it's very similar. It's based on Glenn Moore, it's supposed to be, and but he did add some stuff, so it's not just I don't think it's just a publishing. It's not just a complete ripoff. But I remember in the hubbub that came up during the Kickstarter project is that he thought he had permission or whatever. He even said it on the box, originally said inspired by Glenn Moore or something like that. And then after the whole argument that you didn't really have permission or whatever, he actually took that off the box, which. Sure, I don't know. And now
it's not like, really a solution, but you know, it's, yeah.
To be honest, like I don't know that should have been on the box in the first place. Like maybe in the rules say, hey, I got, you know, I really like Glenn Moore, and it inspired me to like make a Glenn Moore and then some, you know, like Glenn, right, Glenn, right. Even more. I don't know, but so yeah, and Glenn Moore too. I guess the original publisher of Glenn Moore was like mad at him, and then like, well, we're going to make our own version of Glenn Moore too, or whatever. Now that's just coming out. I heard someone was playing it at the Gathering, and I was like, oh, really? I'm curious because I like Glenn Moore so much. How different is it than Lune Architects? And I think the person that was playing it didn't know, either hadn't played Lune Architects or didn't know what I was talking about or didn't know about the similarity. And they were like, I don't know, why would you ask that question? And I was like, oh, well, because they're allegedly supposed to be based on the same thing. You know, it's like comparing Race for the Galaxy to San Juan. I mean, people do that because they're both card game versions of Puerto Rico.
Well, so anyway, let me ask you that then. If we're going on to it, what about Eminent Domain?
What about Eminent Domain?
Lead follow mechanic. I'm just...
Yeah. So yeah, Eminent Domain was, I played a lot of Glory to Rome, Race to the Galaxy, and Dominion. So certainly those things are evident and inspiring in the making of Eminent Domain. But to be honest, a lot of people thought I just like shuffled the rule books of Dominion and Race to the Galaxy together, when really what I was doing, I was thinking,
well, that was not the intent of my question, which I don't feel it's that way, but I'm glad you're just trying to address this.
Well, that's fine. So what I was doing when I made that game was I was thinking about what a card game version of Twilight Imperium might look like. And that's why it's a role selection game, not because of Race for the Galaxy. And that's why it's set in space, too. Not again, because Race for the Galaxy. Certainly, there's some similarities with the production and the shipping. I've also played a lot of Puerto Rico, and it's a lot of inspiration there, too. So, I mean, these things come together. And if something's inspired by Puerto Rico, it's going to look a lot like Race for the Galaxy also. So I don't know. It's hard to say. I think that Eminent Domain is certainly different from each of those games, while it's obviously inspired by them.
I agree. I just wanted to get your feedback about that, because it is, again, when you've got the lead follow mechanics, you've got some deck building aspects of that, but there are mechanics that have different takes, and you know, sure, they some of those existed in different forms prior to it. They are not a derivative. They're building upon something to create something that is a wholly new gaming experience. And that's where we have to draw the line, especially the difference between these plagiarism types of things and the evolution of design within the community. So that's kind of why I brought those up.
Do you guys think, what do you guys think? That En Garde Flash Duel thing, was that legit or was that like too much of a copy or whatever?
I don't know.
Plagiarism.
You
know, I take a very like weird stance on this because to be perfectly honest, no fakeness about it. I just am not interested in taking ad hoc somebody's entire design, making a few tweaks to it, and putting it out as my own. I'm just not interested in that. I get bored very quickly with games that do that because I get it. People like to hone. So even like Tom Lehman, you know, with the Race for the Galaxy. I mean, he has that. What's that other game? The Favor of the Pharaoh. And that's like him honing his own game from something else into a new thing.
Support the King. Yeah.
Yeah, and I just even my own stuff. I don't see myself just like honing it into something else. So for me, it's weird because I look at like stuff like En Garde or even. What was every game David Serlin has done to me is plagiarism, and I get all this stuff
strike?
Has been added to it. Yeah, Puzzle Strike. There's Puzzle Strike, and then there's also what that new one, Codex.
Yeah,
I mean they all like Codex is a blatant ripoff of Mage Wars. It just takes verbatim the thing and then steals from Magic and makes a game. And that's great. That's fine. But I'm just not interested in it. Other people are, and that's cool. It's just, I would never say like he deserves to be sued for those things, but it is total plagiarism in my mind. So I take it, all those ones that we listed earlier, I feel are plagiarism with the exception of Deep Enemy Frontier and that Leaders thing, because I know for a fact that like Cole Whirl has nothing to do with like Root is, I guess it's just another way of doing asymmetrical things. I just there's not enough there for me. It's a very thin line.
Yeah.
I've actually got this is something a lot of people don't know. Probably I've actually got a game that was signed by a publisher and it ended up not coming out because somebody somewhat prominent in the community at the time, was basically claiming that, that I didn't have sole whatever ownership of the game to sell it to a company.
Really?
And so, yeah. And it's a similar situation where I had originally, the guy was a friend of mine and I had worked on a game with him. And then he moved away and we didn't really talk anymore about the game. But I thought the mechanism was good. So I started over, used that main mechanism that was pretty much my idea to begin with, the main part of it. And I built a different game out of it. Sure, similar in some respects because it had that like the same core mechanism, and I finally got something I was happy with after a couple of years, and I was all excited when I got like a European publisher I was interested in, and I was like sweet, and then the guy made a bit of a stink, and I didn't want it to become a big stink, and the publisher didn't either, so he just said, well, how about we don't publish this game? And I said, yeah, I understand, but it's kind of a bummer because it's a good game and I don't feel like I've done. I even talked to a lawyer to make sure I wasn't wrong about my understanding. and I was, as far as I can tell, even talking to a lawyer, like I didn't do anything wrong. But yeah, it's this kind of thing happens every once in a while, and it has an effect, I guess.
But it does
come out.
Yeah, it's sad to see.
So for our listeners, just don't be like Seth.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on really quickly. We're going to get through this last quick hit in game news and we'll get on to the meat of the podcast. But I wanted to say, in their continuing bid to rule the board gaming world, Renegade Game Studios has announced two more titles that we've seen print before, but we're getting facelifts. And this actually reflects back to what we're talking about as far as the topic, the meat of the podcast. Dan Kassar's Arboretum will be released by Renegade Game Studios now. A very solid game, huge fan favorite. It's been out of a little bit unavailable and out of print. It was held, I believe, the rights by Z-Man for a while. Dan at Unpub was wondering kind of what was going to happen with that, but what's happened with it is Renegade has picked it up and will be doing a new version with new art from Beth Sobel. And they are also releasing Jeffrey Aller's Heartland, which is not called Heartland anymore. It's been rebranded as Gun Kamino and set in feudal Japan. And I included a link to the BGG thread that confirms that Gun Camino really is Heartland. I still have Heartland here, which I got in the the huge sale from like 3 or 4 years ago, whatever, that we, when Game Table was going out of business, which is a actual podcast, which if you want to listen to that, you can find that. But anyway, still have not played it. Still have it. Would like to play it. I don't know if I should even mention this, but Jeffrey Ahlers, I probably shouldn't. I'll include a link. I'll include a special link on the notes at dicehateme.com if you want to check out with the podcast that has Jeffrey Ahlers' confirmation about the game being actually Heartland, but also has an interesting interaction that he has with another member of BGG that I found amusing. So you can go to dicehateme.com and find the notes on the podcast and check that out. Did you read it, Daryl? Okay. Is that what you're reading right
now?
Yes,
I did.
Yeah,
yes,
it's hilarious. Anyway. is anybody else?
Listen, everyone's listening to us giggle at what he said.
This is great podcasting. Okay.
That's pretty good.
It is good. All right. So, is everybody ready to move on? I think we are. Let's move on to the meat of the podcast. Alright, so for this podcast, Seth thought it might be a good idea to talk about reprints, rebrands, and anniversary editions of games and what sort of effect they have on the market. So the timing on this one just so happens to coincide with the 10th anniversary edition of Homesteaders that just hit Kickstarter. So we're going to talk a little bit about Homesteaders first and then kind of branch out into more of these types of editions for the hobby itself. But first of all, Seth, since you're with us and we appreciate you coming on, was Tasty Mystery Games always planning on this edition of Homesteaders for a while? And I ask because we've pestered you and Michael Mendez for years about Homesteaders coming back to print.
I personally have.
So it wasn't always planned to be a 10th anniversary because we didn't really... At the beginning, I'm not sure that we were thinking about what would happen, you know, 10 years from now when we published. Homesteaders was one of, for your listeners who might not have heard of it, was one of TMG's launch titles. Like, we came out, Tasty Mystery Games was founded in April 2009, which is actually 9 years ago, by Michael Mendez. And we published two games to start with, and one of them was Homesteaders. Homesteaders is an auction game by Alex Rockwell. It works kind of like, the auctions kind of work like Vegas Showdown or Amon Ray. And it's a game where you auction for the right to build types of buildings. You build buildings of these different types, and they give you incomes. And it's a sort of a strategy game. Alex Rockwell was well known for strategy articles for Puerto Rico and Kalis at the time. And it's a really good, solid, quick, Euro-style, good auction game. So it was a very strong title. And we had a second edition of it. It got reprinted once, and we got like some of the art updated and stuff at the time. But it's been out of print for quite some time. At some point, we were planning on doing a reprint, and then it got delayed for a schedule and pipeline and funding reasons. And then when it finally, I think the idea of the anniversary edition was actually my idea. When we were delaying and we're coming up now on our 10-year anniversary. Like I said, it was founded in 2009, so this is 2018. So we've been around 9 years. And like I keep telling Michael and the other guys at TMG, when Christmas time rolls around, you see a lot of people celebrating in November and not very many people celebrating in January, right? So we could either celebrate, I figured we could either start celebrating this 10th anniversary this year through convention season and coming up to the 10th anniversary, or we could wait until next convention season, which is afterwards. And like, it didn't seem, I don't know, to me, it seemed like it was better to kind of like do it now. Why not? So I'm like, well, we've got this, what a great way to celebrate a 10th anniversary by bringing back these in-demand games that we started with, like Homesteaders. And so I went ahead and made some changes to the game to make it the 10th anniversary edition. And what I had in mind was the Puerto Rico 10th anniversary edition, which came out probably in 2012, a couple years ago. And I really liked Puerto Rico. The problem was the anniversary edition of Puerto Rico cost $100. And I really liked it, and I kind of wanted one, but I already had Puerto Rico, and I couldn't justify spending $100 on a game I already had. I did end up getting it as a gift from somebody, though, and that's great. But I wanted something similar for Homesteaders, but maybe not $100 on the shelf. I wanted it to be more affordable. So that was my idea, and I had this idea maybe a year ago, and I was like, we should totally do this. We should totally do a 10th anniversary thing. We could extend it over a year. We could have some stuff happen at conventions maybe. We could bring out some games, and we could all start it with this 10th anniversary edition. So unfortunately, again, due to funding and pipeline, it was going to have to be delayed until next year. And I was like, oh, man, that's fine. We'll do it next year then. But it turned out that we had a spot in our schedule. If we were to kickstart it, we'd have the funding to do the 10th anniversary edition. So it was decided that we were going to go ahead and put it on Kickstarter, and we could do this now and start celebrating this 10th anniversary of TMG. So that's kind of the backstory. So what's different in the new edition? The base game already had pretty nice components. It came out in 2009, and that was right around the time the Veggie Meeples was happening for Agricola. Like Agricola used to have discs and cubes, and most Euro games at the time, the standard was painted wooden cubes, which is a nice, you know, nice pieces for a Euro game. When we were publishing, though, Michael looked into it and he said, well, how much more would it cost if we had like cow-shaped livestock and apple-shaped food pieces? And it wasn't that much more. And he said, well, why don't we do that then? So even from the beginning, the wooden pieces from this game were pretty nice. And despite some embarrassing production issues we had with the first print run, we had to throw about a third of it away, and we had some issues. But with the second print run, with Panda as the manufacturer, we got thicker cardboard, and it was really nice production to begin with. And we didn't want to deluxify it with the quote-unquote deluxified line, which we'll talk about in a minute, because those are like limited edition, and I really wanted this to be on the shelf. Like, I wanted people to be able, like, this was going to be the next reprint of Homesteaders. It's just a 10th anniversary edition instead of like a third edition.
Right. And I want you to continue, but let's put a pin in that to return to that later, because that's part of the market decisions of things that are happening, which I think is fascinating about this one. But anyway, go ahead.
Sure. So it turns out that this game is on Kickstarter right now, and it's going to have some upgrades, some component upgrades, even though it's got pretty nice production to begin with. We're looking for ways to add some things here and there. For example, the first thing I started with was metal VP tokens. This game has victory point tokens that are little sheriff badges, and they're really cool looking. And I thought, well, what if those were people like these metal coins and all these deluxe versions of games? To be honest, I think there's plenty of metal coins already. Like, I thought metal coins, you know, a lot of the games have metal coins. What if we did metal victory point tokens? That'd be cool, right? So that was the little sheriff badges. So that was the first thing that I upgraded. And then for a while, that was all it's going to be, because it was going to be not on Kickstarter. But now that's on Kickstarter, the new on Kickstarter, as a side note, instead of any stretch goals, instead of having a bunch of stretch goals, we're having just like pre-upgrading games and just seeing like, as people back and what people are interested in, maybe we just start throwing in tasty treats, we're calling them, just kind of thank yous, instead of having to say, oh, if we get this much funding, then we'll throw in the thing. So, so far on the Kickstarter, we've added a 10th anniversary like silver box sleeve, which I think looks really classy. And we've added some silver, the metal silver coins too, on top of the metal VP tokens. So there'll be a lot of metal in this box, apparently. and there might be some other things, depending on how things go. We're getting quotes and everything to see what else we can kind of just toss in there. But again, as this is not a limited edition, deluxified line type of thing, this will be on the shelf it'll be more expensive because it costs a lot to put these metal pieces in the game. But I think the MSRP, if I remember correctly, is $80, not $100. So it's closer to something you can consider walking out of the store with rather than Puerto Rico, which was $100.
You're right. And it's labeled the anniversary edition. So it's going to be applicable to what we're going to talk about a little bit later about anniversary editions and how they do on the shelf and are they justified. Daryl, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I do have a bunch of questions about this. Some of them are voiced already online, but I figure we have Seth here. I can just ask him and then he can answer everyone at once.
We'll see what I can do.
Okay. My biggest thing, I have the very, very first edition of Homesteaders. I have the paper game board and I like it. There's something about it. No other game has it. Anyway, doesn't matter.
I actually like that game board too. It wasn't supposed to come out like that. It was supposed to be cardboard, but they messed up. And, I actually kind of like those,
unique.
It's like folded in half or something. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really unique. When the 10th anniversary thing was announced, I was like, oh, this is so cool. You know, I'm going to update everything. And I was thinking Puerto Rico. I was thinking Ticket to Ride. And then when I went up on Kickstarter, the bits and stuff didn't even bother me. Just one thing. And it didn't so much bother me, but I was like, oh, why didn't they update the art? Like, yeah, they had a chance for the 10th anniversary. Like everything, let's update it. Let's refresh it. And it wasn't. And a lot of people have said that. And I like the original art, but I was still just like, oh, that's weird. Not what I expected.
So,
sure, I've seen that comment online as well. And to be honest, I didn't think that so let's remember that when this, I was coming from the point of view of we were going to reprint it anyway, and mm-hmm. the reprint had been delayed, and I didn't expect this. I didn't really intend for it to be like a wholly new, totally upgraded thing in the first place. I was thinking, you know, my original vision was just the metal VP tokens, some box flare because it's, you know, 10th anniversary edition. And yeah. and then that's it. It was just going to be like the third edition of the game, a little spicier because it's the 10th anniversary edition. But otherwise, I mean, you start doing all kinds of new stuff. You end up having to charge more and stuff like that. So, and I didn't think that art needed updating. The art's, I thought it was fine. So I didn't even look into updating the art. Things changed a little bit when we decided to put it on Kickstarter, partly because people on Kickstarter are interested in more stuff. And that's kind of why you're on Kickstarter, right? Yeah. So that kind of changed the plan a little bit. But as a result, we are adding more components. But I don't think anyone at TMG's thought that we needed to update the art. So we didn't even like think about it, really. Also, that would be a huge delay to get a bunch of art done at this point. And had I decided to do that a year ago, that could have been done. However, looking to do that.
Yeah, no, and I'm not, believe me, I am not standing here saying, Seth, you should redo the art. That should be a thing. No, sure. I get that that ship has way sailed. Yeah. But I was just curious on the masses, you know, sure. why you didn't go that direction.
In addition, what also has happened that I wouldn't want to change the art for was that we also have a long overdue expansion to Homesteaders that's also on this Kickstarter. You can get the expansion. And I had already had the art done for that too, and it all matches the art from the second edition. So now we're talking about changing the art on if we change the art on the anniversary edition, what are we also going to change all the art on this expansion that we already had the art done for? Like, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me either. And again, it hadn't even crossed my mind. Yep. So there you go. There's a reason. People may or may not like that reason, but that is the reason that we didn't address the art at all.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But yeah, I was just going to say on the whole with the components, I agree. Like, they were like, oh, it's not deluxified. I'm like, do you have the original game? Like, that was already pimped.
Yeah,
like,
the original, the second, the second edition, especially, you know, with the custom meeples. And I can remember back in the day, you know, this was, I believe I'm pretty sure I picked up Homesteaders in 2011 or maybe even early 2010. May have been 2010. But I picked it up and I loved it. I think it's one of the best titles that Tasty Minstrel's ever done. But it automatically, it raised the bar because it kind of set the bar for us to know that, okay, well, there's decent and not decent, but really good components coming out of China. And this is one of the first notable ones from Panda. It allowed us to know that, okay, well, there's great stuff coming out of China, but now it's the board game market's open to have these custom bits, whether it's, you know, honestly, it's for the better, but sometimes you have to wonder. And, you know, it was one of the first sort of deluxified types of games. It was never on Kickstarter, though. So
it was not. This was before Kickstarter was really a thing.
Right.
But yeah, like you said, it used to be the standard was painted wooden cubes. But nowadays, I don't think painted wooden cubes will fly in a lot of these games. People want something more custom, more, I don't know, specific to the game maybe, or just more thematic. And I think it all kind of changed around that time when I keep saying the Agricola had those veggie meeples. And I remember people were buying that separately or whatever. And then now it's part of the game.
I bought it separately from my version and had a whole box of custom things that I put into Agricola at the time. But yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and then I was really kind of happy, I guess, that we decided to go with the custom pieces for Homesteaders. We were kind of ahead of the curve, I guess, on that.
Yep. And of course, who doesn't like cow meeples? Well, we're going to definitely have cow meeples in Milkman, which will kickstart in early 2019. Look for that from us. But anyway, they're great. I mean, it's going to be fantastic.
I know a game you can steal them from.
Hey, Panda's already got them. That's right.
Just one of the many things that Mike and TMG were on the forefront of change in the game hobby.
Yeah,
it was the custom meeples.
Well, so let's move on for a second here. We'll return to some of the points for Homesteaders in a second. But We talked a bit about how this is a special edition, but what TMG has been doing in the past couple or two or three years is doing deluxified versions of their games on Kickstarters, on Kickstarter. And not necessarily like their old games, but games that, you know, you're bringing over like Yokohama, for instance, that has the base game, but then you on Kickstarter, you can get the blinged out deluxified with the little TM next to it, deluxified trademark. Version which has, you know, these pimped out things. I think one of the earliest conversations we'll have, which we'll talk about in a second, is it was Orleans. That was one of the earliest ones that had really, like, you know, these pimped out pieces that really added a lot to, in my opinion, gameplay, but also the presentation. How has the trademark deluxified versions of the games done for TMG? And you mentioned that you didn't want it to go deluxified because you wanted this edition to be on the shelf. So what is the dividing line between that? How have the games done, and why is this one different?
Okay, so the deluxified line has done very well. People are really digging it. And you're right, Orleans was the first deluxified, quote-unquote, game that we did. Before that, we did Colosseum Emperor's Edition, but that was a little bit different. It wasn't, we didn't really have the deluxe lines, the deluxified line, like, set in our minds what that meant. And so first we did that, Colosseum Emperor's Edition. Then we did the Orleans Deluxe, and that was really popular. And then we did some other ones, like Yokohama Deluxe was very popular. We did Chimera Station. We did a deluxified version of that. And what I found is the ones that seem to do the best, in my opinion, are the games imports that are that have been out, like maybe they're out in Essen, and they get some good buzz, and then we're importing them, and we do a deluxified version. Those are the ones that tend to, I don't know, get the most attention. Or you know, so Orleans and Yokohama, for example, were really good on that front. But we've also done Chimera Station and Crusaders, which is my game. So those are original titles, and they were both deluxified as well. So, and Crusaders did some big numbers as well. Chimera Station, not as much. And there's a lot of differences between these campaigns, and each time we're trying to figure out, you know, like, what's working and what's not working. So you can kind of see, if you look through the campaigns in chronological order, you can kind of see what we've tried and what was working and what wasn't working. But what we're finding is that I think the deluxified line works really well for Kickstarter, because if you are, let me just say what it is a little bit first. When we do a deluxified Kickstarter, like we just did for Gentis, which did really well, we have a retail version, which is going to be in stores, and then we have the deluxified version. And what it is the deluxified version is many upgrades, as many upgrades as we can fit. And the deluxified version might be MSRP $60, and that'll be what's going to cost on the shelf. The deluxe version is $80 on Kickstarter, but we're not going to put it through distribution, which means we don't have to sell it to distributors for like 65% off, which means we can actually get some, you know, when you buy straight from a publisher, they get a bigger cut of the profits. And they can, in this case, we can put all that cut towards the upgrades, and we can afford better versions, better pieces than we would otherwise. And we can't afford to put them through distribution. So that's what the deluxified line is we have a retail version, which is, it's not bad production. It's, you know, top of the line, like production for a $60 board game, for example. And then we have this extra fancy version where we've taken all the extra money, the extra $20 worth of money, less Kickstarter fees and stuff, and put it all into deluxifying it with metal coins and wooden pieces, which used to be cardboard, and you know, other upgrades like that. And it's been working really well. People dig it. And back, you were talking about Orleans. A lot of people missed out on the Orleans because they didn't hear about it, or they saw it and said, how good can that be? And then it came out and people were like, ooh, that looks neat. I wish I had that. And they found out they couldn't get it. And so a little bit is might be a little bit of that fear missing out that you were talking about earlier. But people who like that kind of thing are starting to get on board, and more people each time are in for the deluxified versions because they're starting to trust that they're going to be good, that the games are going to be good. A lot of people who have been following us for these last 9 years, if they like our games, then they know that they can trust us to put out a game that's good, that they like. And people who have been following these deluxified games can have confidence that they're going to like the pieces. And so this deluxified stuff's working really well for us. And this new version that we did for Gentis, where we just threw everything in the first place, worked so well. I'm sure we're going to try that again in the future.
I'm going to bring Daryl and TC into this now and talk about, for instance, for you two, from a consumer's perspective, you know the ins and out of the industry, but from a consumer perspective, do the deluxified versions of TMG games and others that do this affect how much you want the game and or enjoy the game? Anybody?
Oh, hey, I'm Daryl. Thank you for inviting me to the podcast.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Told you, Azeroth.
As much as I enjoy the game, not so much want the game. Absolutely. Anyone that says they don't want a blinged out game, they're no, that's not a thing. That's not a thing. That's a possibility. I apologize, but it is. But no, it's yeah. I mean, when I was acquiring Orleans, I wanted to deluxify the Orleans, get it out of the way. That way, I had it, and no one else did. Very few people did, and I still have it because I very much enjoy the game. So there you go.
Well, I mean, I am one of those people that you know, as I don't always have the money for buying the special version or getting the little extras. So I do, however, buy Kickstarters a bunch and have supported them in the past. And so I like getting the little extras. I think when I first did Kickstarter, going back to the Glory to Rome and what was that? There was a war game that
D-Day
I got.
Dice.
That was D-Day Dice, right? Yeah. And I have this bag that I still have from that, right? And I had such a, I mean, even with the delays on Glory to Rome, I had such a good experience with that and such a good experience the first time opening D-Day Dice because it was just so much stuff in there. I think I opened it up at home and I had the parents around and they were just like, wow, there's so much stuff in this box. Oh my gosh. Right. And I have not had that experience since then. I've never bought one of the cool mini or not Kickstarters where you just get everything for $500 and yeah. I feel like someday I will do that. I'm just hoping one of my friends makes an amazing game that has that is worth $500 of my money so that I could just dump it all in that. But
Deluxified
at the same time,
Devon.
Yeah, Deluxified Devon. no, I just at the same time though, it's more that I want to help support whatever game that I think is good, and they don't dazzle me anymore. The little deluxified things, if that's the case, I like it, but it's like a trinket more than anything else.
So let me throw out an interesting side effect of this. So this is something I discussed with Dan, and we talked about in the Geek All Stars, but I think I mentioned on this podcast as well. But I love the TMG deluxified stuff, but I don't always pull the trigger. I do a majority of the time pull the trigger on getting some of the Kickstarters, but I don't always do it. The unfortunate side effect of that is, let's say Yokohama, for instance. I saw Yokohama. It looked really interesting to me. I'd heard great buzz about it. I wanted to try it. I just didn't get a chance to. Then the Kickstarter came and went. And then, of course, the copies started coming around. I got a chance to play Yokohama, regular retail version, and deluxified Yokohama. And then it became very tough for me because I'm playing two different versions of the game, and I 100% enjoyed the deluxified version of Yokohama over the retail version. Now, that's not going to be true for every single person, but the way that the deluxified version was presented, the types of things that was in the box, and just the overall game experience that I had with that deluxified version far outweighed the retail one for me. So I had no incentive to really say, well, you know, I'll go grab Yokohama off the shelf. Because I'll get a chance maybe to play it, but I'd rather wait and play it with my friends who might have the deluxified version. Whereas, I mean, primarily, honestly, what you're doing with Homesteaders, I personally would say, okay, it's an $80 game, but it's an anniversary edition, it's a special edition, it's deluxified. I go out, pick that up, because I know it's got quality components in it, it's got cool things that I can bling out my game with. I'm not saying that's the case for every single game, and it's only going to be about a case-by-case basis, but that's a side effect sometimes that's going to happen with these types of editions of games. I don't know where it relates to the original question as much as, how much does it affect you want, how much you want or enjoy a game. In that instance, it did both of those things, where Yokohama... Go ahead, TC.
I just remembered something, the Santorini game. So I've been waiting for Santorini for years, and then all of a sudden I find out that they're going to make a plastic version with this crazy raised board and all this awesome art. And so I went in and I got one of those special abstract looking boxes. So I have I'm one of the whatever 200 suckers that paid an extra $10 to get this cool looking special box, right? But
this is sort of like cool. It's, yeah, this is that, like that, one of your grail things. Yeah.
Yeah, but that made me happy. So I guess going against what I was saying, like, if you really like something, I'm willing to pay a little extra to get that cool thing. But at the same time, I also own the regular version of Orléans, like from overseas, mm-hmm. and I'm super happy with that. I have a good experience with it. So at the same time, as Daryl has like the deluxe version, I don't have an impetus to go out and buy it, even though I really like the game.
Well, and I mean, you can't. The problem is, I mean, you can buy it in the aftermarket, but you're going to pay a pretty penny for it if you want the deluxified version of these games, like Orléans. So that actually creates another element, or is kind of a side effect of doing these things. They do really well, and they absolutely help Tasty Minstrel make these games. But at the same time, there's a little bit of the aftermarket effect of, well, I really want the deluxified one, but I missed the Kickstarter, and now I can't get it unless I pay some person $150 on the BGG Marketplace, you know, to get deluxified Orléans. So anyway, so
first of all, if you do miss a Kickstarter for a deluxified thing, there's a small chance, or a chance for a little while anyway, that you can get it at our booth at conventions. Right. But that's not what I was going to say. One thing that you're talking about, I understand there are going to be people who, when having missed out on the deluxified version, but then seen it, are like disinterested in playing the retail version, even if it's nice, because it's not as nice as the deluxified version. I think though, if you think about like the market and the time of the market, like the Kickstarter happens, and this is something I've been saying. It was the kind of basis behind my whole rant and rave I did a number of years ago against exclusive game content. Mm-hmm. The Kickstarter lasts what, 3-4 weeks, and then people get it and whatever, and the buzz from that lasts a little while, and then it kind of dies. And then 5 years down the road, the game's still on the shelf, right? So those people, anyone who comes to it like a couple months or maybe a year after the Kickstarter, won't have any idea about any of this like deluxified stuff probably. And then as years go by, as people are picking this off the shelf, the group of people that are playing the retail version just grows and grows and grows. The group of people that got your game off Kickstarter is set at whatever number of copies you had on Kickstarter. This was my argument against exclusive game content. If you're like adding stuff to your game to make like 300 people happy on Kickstarter, whereas you're going to piss off like hundreds and thousands of people that
right,
buy your game
in the aftermarket, right?
Is that worth it? Like, I thought that wasn't worth it, and I didn't like there being multiple copies of games. So I'm very much against exclusive game content. Exclusive pieces, that's a little bit different because the game plays the same as long as the retail version has acceptable and good pieces.
I think,
That's kind of the thing. So you are a part of a group that is aware of it on Kickstarter and is likely to see it and might, you know, be disinterested in playing just the retail version, mm-hmm. buying the retail version. But I think that if you look at like the long tail or whatever, the future of this game, this is only true maybe for TMG, not necessarily true for everybody, but we want the game to be on the shelf and we want people to be playing it, right?
Well, like, 100%. And let me talk, what you're bringing up is actually salient points in the fact that and that's why I say it's not really hurting my comments are is it's not hurting TMG, because the most important thing is to have that game on the shelf for people to have a chance to play it, and also just, you know, get it at a good price. They don't have to have the deluxified versions on the shelf to get people to want to buy and play it. There's going to be a certain subset that are going to be that way, that are knowledgeable. They know the Kickstarter was out there. They've seen both of the editions, or they know that there are blinged out copies of these things and they want them, but they are a minority versus the general gaming public that has heard, oh, Yokohama's a good game, and they go to their local game store, and there's Yokohama sitting on the shelf. They don't know that it's not blinged out, or they don't even know if it had a blinged out version. They've just heard somebody talking about Yokohama. They are two different things, and you're right. Long tail is a very, and this is something we don't have to get into, this is a very complex subject as far as like what distributors want, what kind of prices they want to pay on stuff, what they think will sell, both from a retail side and both what retailers will pay and put into their stores. There's a lot of analysis that goes into what the decisions are made as far as what goes on the shelf and what will do well on the shelf. And that's a whole other side conversation, but I wanted to bring it up because I'm glad that you mentioned that, Seth, is that, yes, me personally, like, I don't want to buy the Yokohama retail version, me myself, because I've played the deluxified version. But at the same time, I'm like, if somebody breaks out Yokohama, yeah, I'll play it. I just don't feel like in my personal opinion, because I missed it, I'm going to go out and grab a thing. Now, for instance, you know, Lillian and I had the discussion when Crusaders was on Kickstarter, and we're like, well, we don't want to double back something. She backed Crusaders because we thought it was great. We're like, we're getting all the blinged out stuff from Crusaders, and I'm like, this is going to be great. You know, so we get in the house, we're like, yeah, 100%. We're pulling the trigger on the things that we think that we really want to get from Kickstarter, but the long-term portions of those things are a little bit different in retail. So,
in fact, that's one of the things I worry about when we do things. Like, I feel like we need to be careful to make sure that we're not forgetting about the fact that the deluxe version is limited edition and is going to be, you know, sold out at some point, and our retail version is going to be on the shelf for years to come and probably get reprints, hopefully, right?
Hopefully. So you never know, but you hope. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you hope so, right? It might not, but if it does, that's even more reason to make sure that we're not sacrificing, you know, like, we don't want a bad copy out there on the shelf. We want a top quality copy out there on the shelf that for the price point, right? We don't want you know, if the deluxe version of Yokohama was fantastic and the regular version was just super crappy paper, thin cardboard, and poor production, that'd be a bit of a different thing. We're not looking to do that. We want if you think about, like, random person who just learned about board games and goes into a store and looks on the shelf, they don't know what's been on Kickstarter and what hasn't. They don't know what's got a deluxe edition and what doesn't. And that's a customer that represents a large portion of our overall future customers, and I want them to be happy with the game that they buy.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
So that's a big thing for me. It's not the same if you have, like, people are doing Batman that's, you know, Kickstarter only. They don't have to worry about what's on the shelf because it won't be on the shelf.
Exactly. They're not thinking about long tail. They're going for it's not a quick buck. It's just they're going for a different type of demographic and market for what they're doing for their game. Daryl, did you have a comment?
No, I was agreeing.
Okay. Well, let's move on to more of a broad look instead of just focusing on Tasty Minstrel games. But, well, I'm sure some of these will come up. But so what special editions of games do you all think have done it the best and been worth the price, even if you had that game already in your collection? And I put a couple on here to spark, but Daryl's going to have, I mean, go ahead, because you're going to have.
No, I was going to say, I mean, your two are the immediate. Well, the first two of three that immediately jumped to my head that I'm like, I had to have those. And that's the Ticket to Ride 10th Anniversary and Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico was the first anniversary edition of any game I had. And I absolutely loved it. And it probably spoiled me for all future anniversary editions. Like, okay, you have to update a lot of stuff for an anniversary edition. In my mind at that time. And since then, I've become a game designer and I know I know how things work. 10th anniversary, obviously, the second one. The third one was the redo of St. Petersburg. And I greatly love that game. And I just
I remember where you got that.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe I traded that to you.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. But I needed it. So,
yeah. Very good. I'm glad I found a good home.
So, yeah.
Anybody else have special editions games that you have either bought or considered buying, even though you have them in your collection?
Just the Puerto Rico one that I mentioned before. I'll chime in on that one. Mm-hmm. I ended up getting it. But like I said, I don't know that I would have bought it for myself for the price. But then again, I'm often happy with the old school version. Like, I don't think it's that bad. It's certainly not blinged out, but I don't mind playing with the...
Yeah.
Is it bad that, like, there's certain games that I think get blinged out, like... that I almost like I'm feel like I had to buy it because I didn't want it to go out of stock before I bought it, like Parade, and I regret not buying Arboretum. I'm so glad that it's coming out, but man, those were just gorgeous boxes.
Yeah,
and they just looked great. So I mean, there's even one. So hey, going on the other side of things, there's some times where I'll just buy a game because I'm afraid that it will go out of print and someone might change the art later.
Oh, right. Yeah, you never know. I mean, there's some that where you hear the rumblings of, well, this game's getting low, or somebody says, well, this has been out of print for a while, and you scramble. Okay, like Metropolis. You know, I mean, that's been out of print for forever, it seems, and you were able to find a couple of copies. After we played your game, we were able to secure copies of Metropolis, but now it's really hard to find. And
sure.
It's a great game. I mean, this is a little bit of a side note, but it totally relates to what you're talking about. If somebody does a special edition of something and they release it retail, and you really like that special edition, you're tempted to get it because, is that special edition going to be reprinted? Is it going to be around? Like, for instance, well, the Puerto Rico Anniversary Edition, can you still get that?
No.
Right. So, like, it came and it went. It was the 10th anniversary. You either got it or you didn't.
But it's an interesting question as to whether, like, it might have been that people weren't buying, a whole lot of people weren't buying it for $100. Like, what if that Puerto Rico Anniversary Edition only cost like $80 and maybe more people would have bought it and maybe it would have gotten reprinted? Or maybe it was always intended to be a limited edition. I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, honestly, it's like, yeah. Different publishers have different mindsets as to how they do the things. I think the biggest point, especially what TC mentioned, is like, you just don't know. Like, do you pull the trigger immediately now on an edition that you think is cool and that you really want? Is it going to be available later? Can you get it maybe at more of a discount? It's like, do you get it now because you really like it? It creates this sense, this is kind of going around to the overall point. It creates this sense in the marketplace of it's special and am I going to miss out if I don't do this? So, again, it's a little bit of that FOMO, the fear of missing out concept of marketing. But it's also...
Well, scarcity does work as a marketing tactic, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Apple showed that for tons of years now. We've had that with Nintendo. Unfortunately, I think sometimes they do it unintentionally, but, there's different companies that do that. They limit the amount of the supply, and so the demand goes up simply based upon everybody wants it and everybody's talking about it. There's a huge buzz, and you can't get it, so you're like, ooh, look what I just found. I'm the holder of blah blah blah, I'm the coolest person ever because I got the thing, so I and we'll talk a bit about more of the repercussions whether we agree or disagree for that second. Let's move on to the other side of that. Are there any special editions, reprints, or rebrands that you thought weren't done well or were just completely unnecessary? Anybody?
Supersized Rhino Hero.
Really? So you thought that was completely unnecessary?
Absolutely.
Okay, why? defend your decision there.
I mean, it's supposed to be a family game, right? And you're stacking cards on a tabletop. Well, then you have this giant version where you can't stack cards on a tabletop. And the cards are so giant that if you're playing even off the floor, you need to stand on chairs to keep the game going higher. It's just, it's absurd. It's great for convention presence. But the fact that they've been selling it, I'm just like, why?
Yeah, but
Supersize has a toy factor, but it kind of is it that it has a toy factor, but not the game factor anymore? It like takes the game away. It's like hard to play. And
yeah,
but I viewed Supersize Rhino Hero as not a family game anymore because what happened with Rhino Hero is an interesting phenomenon. So Rhino Hero, what was this? What was 2 years ago at Origins? 3 years ago at Origins? 3 years ago at Origins? I think no, 2015. So yeah. 3 years ago. So 2015 at Origins, Haba USA shows up, Rhino Hero's there. It's the buzz of the con. Everybody's buying it from the thing. We're playing Rhino Hero everywhere. Everybody's got a copy. Not everybody's got a copy. All the copies, they sold out. And I was disappointed because I wasn't able to get a copy, but that's neither here nor there. We played it a ton, and it was a bunch of gamers playing this game. And it happened at other conventions. And so Haba, knowing that all of a sudden, it's not just selling in stores to families, see a bunch of gamers playing this game. And then they go, well, what can we do with this? How do we push the buzz? Now they make this special edition. And it doesn't really matter if it's meant for the core audience of what regular Rhino Hero was or not. It was actually sold, in my opinion, the most to gamers, to adults, the ones that are playing Rhino Hero, whether they're playing with kids or not. So now they're all of a sudden creating this awesome marketing spectrum where this deluxified giant version of something that everybody, that at least the gamers who played original Rhino Hero want to have. Has great convention presence, yes, but also it expands the Haba brand and sales into something else. And also it's fairly limited, so you create that supply and demand influx. So in my opinion, I think it's, I will say that I do agree with what you said, that you're like, well, why does it exist? It doesn't really fit into this certain things. And that's going to happen with some of those things. And one of the things that is on my list actually is the same thing, because I'm just like, well, it's a marketing decision. And I'm like, why does it have to exist? Blah, blah, blah. I won't get to that yet. But go ahead. TC, do you have something?
Container.
Container.
Here's the deal. And it's not because they did actually something cool, right? Like they made it, like it's like mega container. Like the containers are specifically molded, right? And they have actual container ships that are molded to like hold them specifically. If you see pictures of it, it looks pretty sweet. But it's only the the front and the logo. Because, man, that original container, while it may have looked like boring, it's a game called Container, so you can't really do anything. But they jazzed it up so nicely with the original version, with the length. It's like black, the perfect art of these colorful containers, and this little like signature on the top to make it look like, okay, maybe this isn't, maybe Container is the boringest name ever, but look, this is like a limited edition version that's signed copy by somebody in like silver, right? It's so cool. And the new version, it's just like really bad. It looks like someone got into Photoshop that's never been in Photoshop and just picked whatever font they thought was bold and outlined it. And so, I don't know, you'll have to look at the new Container logo, and it just hurts my heart to see the old Container picture and the new one and just go, ugh, missed opportunity. So anyway, but I'm glad that Container's going to be back into print, and I'm also glad that they didn't announce it before I sold my copy of Container for like $200. So thank you, Mercury Games, for not announcing it until after I sold it. Great.
I'm looking at the picture online and I see what you're saying.
Yeah, but it's hey, it's functional. So I mean, I just, anybody who hasn't played Container yet, I mean, those pieces are going to be awesome though. So
well, Seth, I'm going to let you chime in here, and there's one that I gave you the free reign to talk about, but you don't have to talk about it if you don't want to. Is there anything else that you think?
First I'll start with one that you didn't give me, then I'll really quickly mention the one you did.
Sure.
So one thing that I thought of when we were talking about like the Puerto Rico and Ticket to Ride anniversary editions is I almost forgot about this, but Notre Dame and In the Year of the Dragon came out with 10th anniversary editions recently, and I don't think they did anything. I think they were just like,
yeah,
it's just a regular printing, but they're like, it's the 10th anniversary.
Hey, woo-hoo. It's special, yeah, but we didn't really do anything.
$5 more.
And I love both of those games, and I already own them, so I didn't need to go buy them anyway. But I think they might have included like a little expansion in the Notre Dame one, which is, you know, that's good to do. But like in the Year of the Dragon, I remember in the original version, like the punch board really didn't have enough dragon scrolls to go around, but they're not supposed to be limited, but there were way right. fewer than you needed like in any given game. And they didn't even fix that. Like, I think that you need to do something. I think if you're going to call it a 10th anniversary edition, it'd be nice to do something to set it apart from the previous printing.
You can't just announce. I mean, you could say, hey, guess what, it's been around 10 years, hey, have you noticed these games are still on the shelf, versus the here's the 10th anniversary edition, do you have the game yet? Well, I mean, that goes into the, I mean, it's a little misleading, because that goes into somebody like, let's say for instance, you love Notre Dame and In the Year of the Dragon, should I go out and buy these games again? And the decision is no, because there's nothing that adds, there's no blinged out additions, there's no additional content,
right?
Which I think is probably, I mean, additional content is actually really good for an anniversary edition or a special edition, but otherwise you got to think about the actual print. Is it new art? Are there new things inside the box? That's kind of what's pushing it. And it's very disingenuous to not do that.
And I don't think it's got to be much. I mean, it might not be. I already own these games. The 10th anniversary edition might not be for me. Like, I'm not thinking that like every, you know, special edition ought to be something that someone that already likes has the game should run up and buy, right? It might be just for the people on the shelf, and it's like, oh, this game's been around 10 years, it must be good. That's fine. But I do think if you're going to go out of the way and call it a 10th anniversary edition, it'd be nice to do something.
Right.
Right. Like if we did Homesteaders and only did those metal VP tokens and none of the other stuff and call it 10th anniversary, I think that would be okay. It's a nice touch. We've given it a little thought. But if we just reprinted it and didn't change anything, I feel like that's just calling it 10th anniversary doesn't do much for me, you know?
Right.
So I feel like Notre Dame, that's what happened with those two. I feel like they called it a 10th anniversary, but they didn't even fix the things that were like lousy about the first version. So they're still great games though, and if you haven't got them, you should go check them out. But here's the one that I really think, and this is the one we always spar about, I know. So I really like the game Glory to Rome. Anyone who doesn't really like the game Glory to Rome doesn't know what they're missing. And the thing is, Glory to Rome, the original version, had art that a lot of people think is completely lousy. And there was a Blockbox version of Glory to Rome that was very popular, and it was redone art by Heiko Gunther.
Heiko Gunther.
Is that,
mm-hmm.
I got his name right. Sweet. Yeah. And to me, I saw that and I couldn't understand why everyone was going so crazy over it, because to me, and let me preface this, was I play a lot of prototypes, right? My own. And I used to go to like all these unpub type events and see a lot of prototypes. The black box version of Glory to Rome looked like a low ink prototype where all the different cards look very similar and just have like this pale, like minimal art, line art almost, with pale colors that are very similar. And you can, I find it relatively difficult to tell the buildings apart compared to the old version, which had loud, colorful art, kind of cartoony. Now, let me go one step farther. I wouldn't go as far as to say that the old art for Glory to Rome was good. Like, I don't think either one is good. I think there should be better art made. But between the two, they both look like prototype art, but the old version, the colorful version, looks like a better prototype because you can tell the cards apart at a glance versus the low ink, like all the drawings look pretty similar, black box version. That's my rant on Glory to Rome black box.
And, of course, you're wrong, but that's okay. We still love you. No, the Glory to Rome black box version is still one of the greatest Kickstarter deluxified reprint rebrand things ever done. I think it's gorgeous. The the design simplicity of it and Heiko's designs for it are awesome. Everything they put into the box was pure genius. So
even if it's gorgeous as like a piece of art or something, it's just not as usable. So
I don't have a problem with usability.
So
on
for
it
people
all
who play games,
oh, that's wrong. I don't know.
He
about
plays
that
a lot more games than I do. I should wash my tongue.
Yeah, exactly. It's fine. We've had this. It's become a joke, a running joke over the years, ever since it was released, where we joke about like, you know, how much you love the original art. And it's fine. The game itself is what's important because it's a fantastic game. Not everybody's going to like it, but I think that Glory to Rome is one of those games that's just great. I wish that it would have a new edition come out. I've looked into it. I don't know where it lives right now. I don't know what kind of limbo it stands in with Cambridge and Carl. So anyway, if you have a chance out there to play Glory to Rome, any version of it, please do. I think you'll enjoy the black box version the most, but that's just me. I'm glad that I have that copy, and I think that is one that was 100% was a great addition, or a addition to the hobby at the time. It was a landmark thing that happened on Kickstarter that unfortunately ultimately spiraled into the death of a company, but that's neither here nor there. Those are Kickstarter stories, war stories from way back in the day. In my opinion, I question, honestly, Werewords. I mean, I know we've talked about that a little bit before, but I'm just like, you know, Insider was such a beautiful production, so streamlined and great gameplay. But at the same time, you know, we've heard that, yes, there has been additions made to this. Werewords is a different edition. It's not the same game. And that's okay with me. I just think that that particular game itself is just hideous compared to Insider. And I would much rather play Insider, just even from the looks, but also from the simplicity of gameplay. Also, the one thing that I want to bring up as far as the special edition, I'm not saying that it wasn't done well. I think it was done well, and I'm not saying it's not necessarily necessary, because obviously a lot of people really love it, but the whole Century Spice Road kerfluffle of last year, where they announced they had this Golem edition, they said they're not going to do it. They put out Century Spice Road. They said, this is the edition. It sold like crazy at Origins. Everybody had a blast with it. I think it was a great design for Emerson Matsuzzi. And it was a great kind of initial release. But then they came back and they said later, well, you know, quote unquote, we've heard you. You want a special edition. In other words, we know we can make some money. So we're going to put out the Century Spice Road Golem edition everybody was clamoring for. Now they have the other one. So, oh, we're just going to make it, you know, what you can get it at the con. And then after that, they said, well, we've heard you. You want to have this game more so that now you can get it, you know, through special distribution and retail and blah, blah, blah. That kind of stuff cheeses me. I know it's a business decision, and you got to keep thinking about business-wise. But going back on that several times and these new editions of things where, like, for instance, if you were the first adopter of Century Spice Road at Origins, had you known... I would still go with the original Century Spice Road, but I love camels. But most people, well, not most people, but a lot of people would be like, the Golem edition's coming out? Well, I'll wait for that. So that creates a new sense of where is this coming from? What can we believe? What's going on with these new additions? Are they going to be introduced so that either we didn't know that they were coming out, or there's FOMO, or there's completionist syndrome? There's all these different things. I don't know. It just introduces a very sticky wicket in the. Go ahead.
With that one especially, like, not only was it weird how they like kept changing their mind of how it was going to go, but that one, Century Spice Road, was intended from the outset to be a game that combined with other games down the road.
Right.
So it was weird for them to offer two versions, to even offer or think about offering two versions of art to begin with, because that commits them to two versions of art down the road. And then once they got their act together and only did one version, coming out with that Golem of after saying they wouldn't, and then also knowing that they're going to try to match up another game down the road, is just weird to me. And now they've got that second game. Are they going to make a Golem edition of that?
Well, what that's been the speculation. The speculation too, because now we've got the second in the Century series that's going to be released at Origins. Okay, now people are like, okay, we've got the dividing line. Some people bought the Golem edition later. Are they going to want to buy this because it's supposed to be the continuation in the line? It doesn't fit their Golem edition. The people who did Century Spice Road, the original adopters now, are saying like, well, okay, if this other edition is supposed to go with my Century Spice Road version, now I can buy this, but at the same time, I really like the Golem edition. Are they going to release that so now I can have the Golem edition continued? It creates this weird space all about special editions and different editions of games. That's just, I don't know, it's just a very bizarre phenomenon, especially now, because of how well those editions have sold. Anywho, let's move on. Are there any games that you feel could benefit from a reprint, rebrand, or special edition?
Sure. So online, recently, and this is a newer title, but I play it enough when I have time that, anyway, online there's been speculation of an Azul special edition where everything looks twice the size.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is crazy, but yeah.
I would get it if it came out. It's like in a wooden box briefcase kind of thing. The player boards are neoprene play mats. I'd get it. They're not a question in my mind. That would be the next special edition I would pick up.
And
if we had video, you'd see me putting my thumbs down right now.
That's you. But I'm going to talk to Daryl for 1 second because this is Daryl's jam. Let's just back it up for a second. Why would you plunk down the money for that?
Because it's pretty.
I'm just trying to make it. I'm trying to get behind the motives behind this so we can understand why these things exist. But
I mean, I do enjoy the bigger is better, but I only want that if I thoroughly enjoy the game. So, case in point, you know, like we said earlier, Puerto Rico, Ticket to Ride, St. Petersburg, like Azul, it's just a larger table presence for a game that's already super pretty. And so I want that. I have the table for it. You know that. I'm not one to shy away from pimping out games that I thoroughly enjoy, and this is already done for me. So case in point, like, look at the Doctor Who that I have from Gale Force. I was able to get all the plastic demos instead of the punch board from when they got their games in. So it's I'm all about pimping out and making it look really cool when I'm playing it. So
can I ask you a question, Daryl?
What?
Like, how much is too much? Because Azul is fine game, but I feel like it doesn't really need an upgraded version. I do see people are ordering like a different colored piece, which is odd to me because then it won't match your board. And then you're saying you'd be interested in like the bigger version that they're talking about. How big is too big? How much is too much? Is there such a thing?
I think it's all based on demand, right?
Sure, but for you, how big would those pieces have to be before you're like, nah, it's too big?
Pretty much any larger than this big version.
Okay. You want it to fit on a table, basically. Well, it's the same thing I put in, I didn't mention this, but then the one that I said, is it really necessary? The huge Takanoko version. Like, that thing is huge. I mean, it takes up a ton of table space. But there's people who love it. It's $300,
It's still big.
It's a little big. Yeah. But it's a valid question. And how many versions, I mean, even if they put that out, like, how many versions do they produce? Then you get into the whole thing. Well, I mean, they've still got to do economies of scale. Otherwise, things will cost $300, which the giant version of Takanoko does. But then the giant version of Azul is $300. Are you willing to pay $300 for giant Azul? You personally, Daryl?
No.
So there you go. So
then there is a point.
There is definitely a point. Anybody else have any games you feel could benefit from a reprint, rebrand, or special edition?
food chain magnate.
Oh, okay.
I've wanted to play this game for a while, but the overall presentation and art, and especially the board itself and how it interlocks with those, it looks like a prototype. And so I really don't have any interest in it. And I know I should, because it's kind of like people tell me it's up my alley, even though those Splatterspiel games don't necessarily appeal to me because they're very abstract. I don't know, dude, it grates on me, because I think they're trying to get like a 50s sort of food, like fast food, early McDonald's style vibe, and it's like they got somebody just out of college to try to do it, you know, and it just doesn't work, and the half of it isn't cohesive. So I would be really down with playing it if I had like a really cool version, but yeah. It's never going to happen.
That company is
set in their ways, and I just don't see it ever happening.
You know, well, speaking of something I think will never happen, but it's along the same lines. And I agree with you about Food Chain Magnet. It's one that I've always wanted to play. I've never had a chance to, but at the same time, I'm with you. I'm like, well, if there's something else that could be, you know, brought into the fray for this, as far as like, you know, a pimped version, this would be amazing. My opinion on this, and something that will never happen, is a GMT Games release, and that's Twilight Struggle. I think not only they were actually good about going back and revisiting Twilight Struggle and giving it an actual, you know, cardboard board. All the pieces in Twilight Struggle are fine. The actual design and the presentation of the game itself is fine, but it's a GMT production, so it has a certain aesthetic to it. I would love to see like an anniversary edition of Twilight Struggle come out and have pimped pieces and, you know, this deluxe, like maybe it's a neoprene board or something. I don't know. I just think,
you know, I actually think they've already done their 10th anniversary edition. I think we could probably put this in that pile of games that deserve.
They didn't do
better.
Anything. But, yeah. Yeah.
No, I mean, a lot of people who are war gamers will tell you, oh, well, it's functional for a reason. Just like they talk about, like,
yeah,
the original dominant species.
Yeah,
they're like,
you're right.
Well, it's pastel and ugly for a reason. Then you can see all the pieces. And it's like, no, I mean, there is definitely a point where you can get too chromed out. Both of those games have not even come close to scraping the bottom of the barrel of getting to the point where they could, you could say that they are too chromed out. So, I love that they've upgraded the boards, and they have done some new art to Twilight Struggle with the new editions and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think there's actually some people, I see people post like these wooden boxes that they put out too for Twilight Struggle, and that's cool. But focus on the actual game experience, the cards, the arts, the actual art, the incidental art.
Right, right.
Like,
exactly.
If that looks good, it would be awesome.
Yeah, imagine a really pimped out new art version of Twilight Struggle. I mean, it's already, you know, I mean, it had its reign at the top of BGG for a while there. It's still in the top, well, it's still in the top 10, right?
I think so, yeah.
I'm pretty sure. I mean, it's like, give this game its due, you know, put out a new version and it really just do it well. So, anyway, I'm not saying that the version that the Twilight Struggle right now is horrible. It's not. It looks fine. It does its job. It's actually really fairly attractive for a GMT game. But I'd love to see something else done. Now, Seth, you have a couple of notes here that I think you want to talk about. Go for it.
Not to be so too self-serving, but I think my first game, Terra Prime, that came out 9 years ago from TMG, and also suffered some of the poor production that Homesteaders did, that never did see a reprint. And I actually think that game, I played it recently, I think it holds up, and I think it could benefit from a reprint, to be honest. Also, perhaps Isle of Trains, Chris? Isle of Trains? Reprint, huh?
I don't know what you're talking about.
I think that game's perfect as is.
That's right. Why does it need a rebrand or anything like that? It's beautiful. No.
Well, you said could benefit from a rebrand.
It's selling well. We already have like two different foreign versions out, and we're going to have the new version of Isle of Trains available before too long. Actually, I got an email that I'll share with you later, Seth, but I got an email from Daniel Gadara, which is going to be the updated art for the Isle of Trains expansion, All Aboard, which will introduce on Kickstarter before too long. And that will introduce a giant monkey-sized box like Bottom of the Night, so everybody can put both the original Isle of Trains and the expansion inside the box and have plenty of space. So awesome. We'll have more information about that as we get closer to the Kickstarter date, and I'll be even posting some like preview art that Daniel has is going to be sharing in the next probably about 2 to 3 weeks. So we're on track to get that out there. I'm excited about it. It's going to be awesome. So we're getting to the end of the meet here. We've run a bit long, but let's talk about this. How do you all feel that these special editions do in the market? And are they good for the hobby, or do they sometimes feel like cash grabs? And Seth has a feeling about the word cash grabs. But so how do you feel that these special editions do in the market? Do they add something to the hobby, or do they detract? Anybody?
I think it depends on the game status. So if it's an evergreen title, mm-hmm. then I think it makes sense. You're updating everything. You're keeping the game fresh. You're in mind. If it's a title that has been popular and has gone away, much like Homesteaders, to bring it back and to say, look, here's a new version, we've updated some stuff, and hey, look, here's an expansion to go with it, that makes sense too. Anything else, it's just... I also don't like the term cash grabs, but I feel like it's just a...
It was a flippant term.
Odd thing.
It's a flippant term. But it is, it's basically, it's a way to revitalize or re-energize a, not necessarily a lagging product, but give new life to something that's been out in a while.
It's just, if everything becomes a special edition, then nothing's a special edition.
Well, to an extent, I agree with that. Yeah.
And to an extent, it's getting to a way, and it's getting to a way where, especially those Kickstarter games, where it's just like, that's the special edition. If it's on Kickstarter and you get it through Kickstarter, that's the special edition, because you had to appease the Kickstarter backers by throwing in something that they can only get through Kickstarter. And it's, like it or not, that becomes the special, that's the Kickstarter edition, or the, you know, the special edition, or the deluxified, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. That becomes what that thing is. So we are seeing more and more special editions in the market. They just may not be labeled as the special editions, but they're there. And in a way, it's also souring people's reception of games.
Yeah. Well, that relates to, I mean, I'll let the rest of you speak in one second, but it relates to my last question, which I'm just going to roll into this one, is like, how soon is too soon for a special edition or anniversary edition? And I think that what happened was Takedo did that not too long ago. It was like only 2 or 3 years after Takedo had come out and they released a special edition, had his new things on the market. It's like, how soon do you like roll things out to become this like new version of something that's already doing well in the marketplace?
Well, I think it might be tricky, because like, to one extent, you want to fight, if you got a hit, you want to strike while the iron's hot, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if Takedo was super popular, but if it was, I could see them saying, oh, dang, let's capitalize on this by selling all these people the same game again by making it fancy. You know, now, that might get into where people talk about cash grabs, in quotes, because that's, I mean, we're selling games. We're in it to make money.
It's
anyone
a business.
Making money could be described as a cash grab. So to say that you're against cash grabs means you don't want people to sell games? Like, there's a negative connotation. What it really means is they feel like it's some sort of unnecessary, I don't know.
That it's unnecessary.
Yeah,
that was my. That's my. Basically, when somebody says that this feels like a cash grab, and I hear this a lot in the community and also in Slack and various and other things like that. But when people like view something and say like, okay, well this is out there, and all of a sudden, well that feels like a cash grab because it's simply done for the purposes of making money. But to be honest with you, you're right. It is a business.
So is everything else.
Right. It is. It's true. But I will say we are all involved in a community that is fairly tight-knit, at least on the side that are knowledgeable and talking on BGG and several other places, Twitter and Reddit, where there is an attitude of we should aspire to go beyond that. But the reality is you can't have a business without making money. But you have to think about the perception of what it's going to be in the marketplace and weigh whether it's worth it to get that money or to get some money and reserve your reputation and bank it into something later. So
I do have one salient thing to say about whether or not it's good for the hobby to have these special editions.
Mm-hmm.
I have a hard time thinking that it's bad for the hobby. And here's why.
Okay.
It's kind of like what I said before. Like, if you take the special edition, the length of time that's available, and maybe a little longer because until it's like out of the public perception or whatever, and you remove that, that's a limited specific amount of time, and it's smaller than the lifeline of the, you know, I guess it depends if you're talking about games that you're trying to reprint and sell for a long time. But that the limited edition is a very small period of time compared to the lifespan of the game. So if you just ignore that, maybe you're a player who's I'm not aware of that, and they walk up to the shelf, like, it doesn't affect you. So I think it's hard to say it's bad for the hobby, because that'll go away and it's like it was never there. Whereas it could be good for the hobby, because it gets people excited about a particular game. Maybe it makes the publishers the money they need to keep going. Maybe these deluxified editions, for example, are selling really well and it gets people playing the game. And then when the game comes out in retail, it's got some buzz, or, you know, the best advertising for a game is people playing it, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I could see ways that it could be good for the hobby, and I have a hard time seeing ways for it to be bad for the hobby.
Okay, that's fair. TC, do you have any thoughts about this?
I was just thinking about, like, the fact that, like, anniversary editions were kind of like, they're kind of like an in-joke. Like, well, not this year, last year. Last year, they were kind of like the in-joke. There were so many anniversary editions coming out that it was like, are we really, like, are we doing this? And I think there was even a game that they were they didn't call it, but they put up a Kickstarter. I think it was Queen Games even put up a Kickstarter for, like, a fifth anniversary edition. And you're like, and that gets to the whole
Queen Games is
how soon is too soon, right?
Right.
And 5 years seems too soon, right? But you know, even back way back when, like, with the Viva Java, the dice game, right? We made the Game of the Year edition.
Like, right. Tongue in cheek. But yeah,
tongue in cheek. But that was because that was, like, the joke of the time for, like, video games, right? Like, Game of the Year. So I feel like we're still 10 years out from the Game of the Year editions, right? Like, so right now, I would say 5 years is too soon. 10 years is right on the money. Because it's like out of the public eye, but you want to bring it right back. And if it's a really good game, then yeah, it'll sell well again. But yeah, Game of the Year edition, I think that's the new thing. But we won't see that 5 years from now. That's when we'll see it.
TC, how do you feel about Kill Dr. Lucky's 9.5 year anniversary or something like that?
The problem with that game was that it already had its fifth anniversary and 9.5 and 11 and 12th, right? Like, it's still in print. Like, why were they... Whatever. Okay, there's another thing. Don't do a special edition or anniversary edition if you already still have the game readily available in print. Just... That, to me, is a cash grab. That would be the definition of a cash grab in this hobby.
Well, but,
also, Bears versus Babies is a definition of a cash grab.
Oh, well, there you go. See, that goes back to the original, that full circle. Thank you for bringing it back around. Full circle back to the Kickstarter thing. Yes. Unstable Unicorns, cash grab. I'm sorry. I mean, it might be a great game, but yeah, you're banking on this certain subset of people, and you're going to make some money on Kickstarter. Nothing wrong with that. We live in a capitalist society. Go for it. But it doesn't. I still reserve the right to gripe about it on the state of games.
Similarly, what strikes me when I hear the words crash grab, what comes to mind to me is these licensed IPs that are just slapped on a game that, you know, isn't necessarily a good game at all. It just has pictures of Batman on it or whatever. luckily, nowadays, we're getting, like, good games that also have IPs. So that's kind of changing. But for years...
There was a stigma against it. But we've had some really... Starting with Gale Force 9 doing a really good job with their IPs. And we've had some other companies now learning that they can actually make money, more money, if they make a good game with an IP that actually stays in the market. So that's good. And I think it's a great... move forward with our hobby. Anybody else have anything to add to what we've talked about before we move on to the backside of the podcast? I think we're good, right? All right.
Nope.
Let's do it. All right, let's dig into notable Kickstarters really quickly here. We, of course, have mentioned it previously, and Seth has outlined all the cool things, but Homesteaders 10th Anniversary Edition, no tongue-in-cheek there. I 100%, and I speak for Daryl and TC along with this, we recommend, if you have not played Homesteaders and you do not have Homesteaders, pick up this copy. Pick up this edition, and even if you own Homesteaders, go and check out the additional content, what's been blinged in it. You might want a new copy. Definitely go check it out, because I do personally feel like it's on my A-Team shelf. It's been on the A-Team shelf for, well, probably 9 years now. Maybe 8 years, I think. 2010, I think I got 2010. But anyway, I think it's a great edition. Great, one of the greatest games that TMG has put out, and I'm glad to see it in print again. So, go ahead.
I was going to say really quickly, even for people who have the game and aren't interested in the updated version for 10th anniversary, you might want to check the Kickstarter out anyway and look at the expansion.
Right.
There's a lot of good stuff in the expansion.
And that's probably, I mean, I'm happy with my second edition copy of Homesteaders, but I want to support the campaign and probably am going to back here pretty soon for the expansion itself, because I definitely want that additional content for the game, because I love the game. And every now and then I'll bring it, you know, to a convention. I know TC had it in his trunk for like 5 years. Every time he'd show up, he'd have Homesteaders around with him. So,
yeah, Homesteaders and Isbahan all day.
That's right. The staples. We don't give Homesteaders enough coverage as much as we do as Isbahan, but Homesteaders is a great game. So, I'm going to say pertinent to our topic, Queen Games has the Alhambra Designer's Edition. How many freaking editions of Alhambra are there?
But this is the designer edition.
Right. It has 9 exclusive expansions by famous designers. Uh-huh. Rudiger Dorn, yeah. Mike Elliott, Stefan Feld, Dirk Hinn, Emmanuel Ornella, Michael Rennick, M. Ruskowski, and Michael Sibelbeck, and Michael Schacht, and Klaus-Jürgen Rede.
All so, hacks.
All complete hacks that are adding. All I can say is if they can save this game for me, I would back this Kickstarter. But I'm skeptical. Anyway, I just want to mention it because, again, it is a special edition. It's limited designer's edition. There are no shortage of people who are wanting to back this on Kickstarter. $236,000 or the $12,146 goal. 25 days to go on this. If you like Alhambra, you'll probably want to get this because it has these new, it has a tile dispenser tower, which is basically a card construction, which is fine. It looks kind of neat. But then they have these expansions that are designed by 9 famous designers, which is an interesting red tape for all this stuff. Anyway, that's all I have to say about that. Does anybody want to comment on Queen Games and what they do? No? Okay. We'll move on then. Hellboy. Is anybody backing this?
No.
Are you backing it for like $500, Chris?
No.
I thought this was a thing.
It is a thing. I'm not one of those things. However, it is one of the better looking kind of IP stuff that people put out. I love Hellboy. I love the fact that they have Mike Mignola art in here. It's by Mantic Games and associated with Dark Horse. And the miniatures look fantastic. But again, this is another one of those like Batman games that just hit Kickstarter where you're basically backing for this tons of minis. And the cool thing about this is it is Hellboy, and it's all the different, you know, portions of the Hellboy universe, which I love. But yeah, we're talking at $100 or more for retailer pledge, £95 or more for the agent pledge, which actually is not bad for everything you get inside this, but there's a lot of other things that kind of get added on and tacked on. So I wanted to mention it because I don't know that I honestly can't say that there's much game there, but if it recreates the Hellboy universe and you're really into Hellboy, go and check it out. Fireball Island, I'll mention probably by the time the podcast drops, only about 2 days left as of this podcast to back that. If you haven't backed it, go back it because it's freaking awesome. I'm backing for all the things, and I have enjoyed my 3 plays of the game. I'm glad that I'm on board for all of this. I can't wait till it's done. I really hope they make their November deadline so I can play it around Christmas with all my friends and their kids. I will mention Fleet, the dice game. Again, as of this podcast, probably about 2 days left on this one. This is by our friends Matt Riddle and Ben Pinchback. Of course, it has content for the original Fleet game, which is one of my favorite games of all time. It should be on your playlist if you haven't already. Go and back Fleet, the dice game. I was actually part of the playtest team and not in development, but gave them feedback on things they could make for it. This is great. It's fun. It's super fun.
They have content for Fleet in that?
Yep. They do.
They stole my idea, but they're doing it first. Now we're gonna have a dice game called Rolled West, which is kind of like a Gold West dice game, mm-hmm. and it's gonna have a promo for Gold West in it. So
that reminds me, while I have you, Daniel wanted to show me Rolled West at the Carbon Edison Awards, and I was not able to play it at that time. But I wanted to. He gave me like a couple of score sheets and stuff like that. I wanted to make sure that it was okay with you that he sent me files so I can print it and play it here.
Sure.
Okay.
We are going to update that, and I think we're looking into dry erase instead of score sheets because it'll fit better.
Boo.
But
anyway, that's just my opinion.
Well, the score sheet's awfully small, like otherwise.
It is small. He was asking about the typography on the score sheet and the design and stuff like that. So anyway, we'll talk later, but I just wanted to be able to play it because it sounds awesome. And lastly, for me at least, is Fire Tower, which I did not get a chance to play at PAX East, but was in the Unpub area. It also is an Unpub alum. They've done really well, which is good because they've pushed this game for quite a bit. This is by Runaway Parade. They've made $30,000 of their $8,000 goal. There's 24 days to go for this. This is a true indie endeavor. This is what we consider one of the reasons Kickstarter exists, is, or the main reason Kickstarter exists. Go and support this project. Check it out. There's some gameplay videos. It plays super fast, and it was they played so many games of this at PAX East, and it looks super cool on the table. It has a ton of yellow taint or orange taint in the game too. So if you really love your plastic gems, go and check it out. Anybody else have any Kickstarters that they're backing or would like to mention? Crickets. Yeah.
I don't think I do.
I'm broke, yo.
Yeah, me too, after last month. Holy cow. So much stuff. Unpub news, Daryl.
We'll be at Origins. So table signups are there. I believe we're pretty much, it's all waiting lists for all the rooms or for all the times currently. And the next thing is we're either going to do speed dating or we may do the designer Shark Tank thing at Origins. We're kind of working through logistics and seeing what spaces we can get. That'll help us determine what we're going to do.
Can I be a part of that?
I will be in touch if that's the case.
Because that was fun. I want to do that again. Okay. I'm also signed up for several tables. However, I'm not sure I'll be able to hold all of them. So y'all on the wait list, get on the wait list. There may be some, there's always some openings. There's always flexibility for the Unpub room. TC News?
Well, hey, you know what? If anyone's going to be in the Atlanta area coming up here on the next weekend, I think, what is that? The day is like the 3rd or May?
4th of May? 4th, 5th, and 6th.
4th, 5th, and 6th. Yes. Okay, so this weekend, if you're listening to this podcast, go out to ProtoSpiel Atlanta or hit me up on Twitter and let me know, and you know, maybe we can hang out afterwards. I mean, but I'll be around, I'll be playing games, I'll be with designers and everything, and I think it's just an awesome experience. So anybody that's going to be there, I'll see you there. And you know, Origins is coming up, so maybe so I'll be at Origins too.
Come yeah, Origins me. Is coming up fast.
Be my friend.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you're going to be hanging out in the Raleigh-Durham area. We're going to be gaming with the TC. Yeah.
So yeah, I'll be around. I'll be around this next weekend for the North Carolina area.
And so all North Carolinians out there listening, pay attention to Twitter so we can come out and game with TC. Seth, how about you?
So I won't be at Origins this year, nor Gen Con.
No.
Because
go ahead.
Yeah.
Because in T-minus about 4 weeks, I'll be having a little boy.
Congrats.
My wife will be having a little boy, I guess. And so that'll be news. That's pretty new. But that'll keep me away from some conventions for a little bit. But that's going to be new and exciting, and I'll have to see how that goes. So that's number one. Other than that, so in addition to the Homesteaders Anniversary Edition with that New Beginnings expansion, which is on Kickstarter right now, TMG is also going to be doing some more stuff to commemorate our 10 years in the business. Over the next year, you can expect to see some more reprints of some of our older, more popular titles, the out-of-print ones, like Belfort, for example.
And you like can I said, only I agree. You can only do the reprint of Belfort if you put the Dice Ate Me Game of the Year badge on that.
Which we did last time, right?
You did. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like I said before, I think anything we do, we'll probably add a little something, be it some promo content, which we'd also make available separately for people that already have the game, or component upgrades or whatever. But the whole thing will culminate next year, the plan is, with a new version of Terra Prime, which I hinted at earlier. I'm finally going to get a chance to get a redo on my first published game. It's going to have updated rules with stuff I've learned over the last 9-10 years. Actually, I made that game in 2006, so even longer. And it's got I made an expansion for it a while ago that never saw the light of day. So I've included the expansion. I've updated the rules a bit. We're getting new art and setting it in the Eminent Domain universe. So it's a prequel to the card game. So you watch for Eminent Domain Origins next year, maybe Gen Con or
something. That's exciting.
That is very exciting for me personally, because like I said, I was my first foray into game in my game design, my first game coming out was kind of like tainted a little bit by this bad production that we had. And I don't know, I've said on other podcasts like what happened, and I don't want to get into that, but I always felt like bummed out that that game never really got the reception. Everyone that I've talked to that has played it seems to like it, but so few people have played it. I think I'm excited to get a second chance to see that game come out and see play, and hopefully more updated for today's standards.
Sounds great.
And then other than that, it's just the production's going on for my Crusaders game that you mentioned. And I've started testing some expansion content for it just in case it goes over well when it comes out.
And even if it doesn't, just put it out. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well,
make a special edition with new expansion content. And there you go. Oh, I think it'll do well. It looked awesome, and I love the art and design from Adam. And it looks. I can't wait for that to show up. What's the production timeline on that right now? I'm bad. I'm one of those people who doesn't read their updates.
Once it gets out of playtesting and gets to the manufacturing, it's kind of out of my hands, and I don't even really know.
Okay, all that's of the fair. Details. That's fair.
So to be honest, I'm not sure. I think it's out in the process of being manufactured. So I don't know how long it takes. At that point, a couple of months, I guess, for the. They got to print it, then they got to ship it across the ocean, then it's got to, you know how it goes. So yeah, I'm not sure exactly, but I'm looking forward to it.
I know how that goes, for sure. But I'm definitely looking forward to it as well. It looks like a great game, a great production. Well, thanks for joining us, Seth. That's it for this episode of State of Games. We'll be back next time with even more great board game discussion. And of course, we love hearing from all of you. A quick shout out to Roscoe Shock for emailing us and saying hi. He said that more of the podcast should be done in the style of our closing May All Your Rolls Be Sixes, because the unsynced voices and TC's reticence lend a delightful awkwardness. Pretty sure he meant that in an endearing way and told us to keep up the good work.
So we should all just talk over each other. That's why I'm doing it right now.
Absolutely. We should totally just like style of moonlighting. We'll just talk over each other the entire podcast. So we want to thank Roscoe. Also, Roscoe, I believe, said he was going to be at Proto Atlanta. So Roscoe, if you're listening, mm-hmm. before you go to Proto Atlanta, be sure to stop by and say hey to TC. Unfortunately, I will not be there. I have an exam at 7 p.m. on Friday night, which sucks.
I already played one of his games this last weekend. So
oh, sweet.
I'll see him there too.
Well, there you go. All right. So anyway, if you want to give us feedback or have any topics or new segments you'd like to hear about, we can add them to the show. You can email those ideas to thestateofgames@gmail.com or tweet them at @thestateofgames. You can also go to dicehateme.com and comment on the podcast, or join Guild 1903 on BoardGameGeek.com. You can also hit me up on Twitter at @DiceHateMe and on Instagram, where I just had a Feudum giveaway, and I'm going to have a new one for Twitter and Instagram before too long, possibly in relation to this podcast, so stay tuned. What about the rest of you?
Clearly, you're getting all the review copy gold, and PC and I are getting nothing.
Your check's in the mail.
That's why I started a rogue Patreon. Everybody,
there are three people on this podcast from day to day. So, anyway, you can find me on Twitter at @GetLouder, usually complaining to Chris about something.
And I am at @PuppyShogun on the Twitter. Hit me up. Again, I'm going to be in Georgia, and I'm going to be in North Carolina. So if you want to show me a really good place to eat that's, southern, really southern, I'm in. Okay.
And I'm Central on BGG, and I'm also at Central on Twitter. And Chris, how about this? For your next giveaway, or for a giveaway for your thing, I'll send you a copy of Harvest and a copy of Pioneer Days that you can give away.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. Can I have personal copies of those too? And so that Daryl and TC can't have any of those?
You can rig the contest.
I could totally rig the contest. Actually, it's interesting you mentioned Harvest, because this past weekend, Matt Wolf tweeted at me that he found a new candidate for a one-hour wonder, and it's Harvest, which I have not played yet, but I'm very much looking forward to it. But yeah, I will definitely let you know. That would be a great giveaway for the podcast. Greatly appreciate it. All right.
Sure.
Well, until next time, I'm Dice Hate Me.
I'm Get Louder.
I'm Puppy Shogun.
And I'm Central.
Saying thanks for listening, and may all your rolls be sixes.
That was awful.